Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
But white always stands by itself. On every time they have taken the classification, set up a classification system, white is not even in alphabetical order. White is always at the top and always stands alone. It starts off, just look at any of the scales, I mean, where it says racial classifications. Pick out any of them. At the top is white. And then from there, I mean, they just go into all kinds of stuff. Guamanian, Chamorro, some other race, and on and on and on. Just look at any, punch it up on the computer, all the racial classifications, and see what you're looking at. White is always stands alone. Black people, African American, Negro, Black, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, all this type of thing. Guamanian, Puerto Rican, Hawaiian, Native American, and our Alaskan Native, and all of that other confusion. Everybody else is some kind of confusion. It ain't no confusion about W-H-I-T-E. Just look at it on paper. That's the way it is. White, W-H-I-T-E. That's all. Period behind that. It ain't no strung out about white Scandinavian, white Italian, or white Cubans, or none of that. These are not Fuller's classifications. These are the classifications that are official classifications for the whole world. So a question is raised, who makes these classifications? And I say, somebody white. Who else? Because even if you're going to do it in what you call a democratic fashion, or, you know, algebraic fashion, at least, you would say, okay, everything being equal, or supposed to be, white would be somewhere near the bottom in the listing, simply because it starts with the word W. Just on that alone. No, but they put white at the top, and there's a reason for that. Has anybody thought of that? Every time a census is taken, white starts, you know, white, we start with white, and then we'll deal with the rest of the scraps later. But get that on the board first. Why? Because that's the only one that counts.
The Biden administration is on track to make another historic political appointment. Robert Santos could become the first person of color confirmed by the Senate to lead the U.S. Census Bureau. But there was an earlier trailblazer who made history more than two decades ago. NPR's census correspondent Hansi Lo Wong reports.
A couple of years before the start of the 2000 census, James F. Holmes got a surprise offer that would break with more than two centuries of U.S. history.
I couldn't for the life of me figure out why the Secretary of Commerce wanted to talk with me about census issues.
The Census Bureau, which is overseen by the Commerce Secretary, had just become leaderless. Its previous director had resigned as the agency was preparing to conduct the headcount used to determine political representation and guide federal funding for the next decade. And Holmes, who was running one of the Bureau's regional offices, was temporarily promoted to become the leader of the entire Bureau.
They were interested in someone that understood census operations, and my name kept coming up.
Holmes joined the Bureau as a survey statistician back in 1968, after growing up in a small, segregated town in Georgia and graduating from Albany State University, a historically black school.
It didn't take me very long to understand that I was just as prepared, just as smart as my white counterparts. And when I came to that realization, I never looked back.
Holmes says when he was named the Bureau's acting director in 1998, it didn't immediately dawn on him that he had also become the first ever person of color to head the U.S. Census. And since the end of his almost nine-month stint, the Bureau has yet to have another director of color.
To say that it's long overdue is the understatement of the century. The first census director was Thomas Jefferson, and you can do the math.
Going back to that first census back in 1790, when an enslaved person was counted as 3/5 of a free person and some Native Americans were not counted at all, that's a total of more than 36 white leaders of the census. That lack of diversity has long been a concern for some inside the Bureau.
There was no reason to question that on one side of the table, because this is the way it's always been.
Jerry Green worked at the Bureau for more than 2 decades and was a member of its affinity group for African-American managers.
But from the standpoint of people of color, I know that with each change in administration, there are people who await and hope that they will see some reflection of their existence in the United States as a people.
Since the Census Bureau became a permanent agency in 1902, its directors have been chosen by the president and confirmed by the Senate, which recently held a hearing with President Biden's pick, Robert Santos, who's also the current president of the American Statistical Association.
Born and raised in the barrios of my native San Antonio, I was fortunate to be in a Mexican-American family whose parents secured civil servant jobs at Kelly Air Force Base.
I'm from Texas, too, and multi-generational Mexican-American from Texas. So I'm all like, yay, like this is someone who will understand those kinds of issues, I think, is just really, really great.
Julie Dowling is a professor of Latin American and Latino studies at the University of Illinois, who recently chaired one of the Census Bureau's committees of outside advisors. Dowling says Santos could help rebuild public trust after the controversy over the Trump administration's failed push for a citizenship question.
I think that that could be really helpful in terms of turning the tide towards better relations, that people will understand the Census Bureau not as it was being used during the Trump administration, you know, where we basically had interference.
If Santos's nomination gets the Senate's approval, he would join the long list of men who have been Census Bureau director. So far, only 2 women have taken on that role, and they are both white. Hanzi Luong, NPR News.
My twin niece and nephew got their first swimming lesson when they were 18 months old. My sister Jean was determined that they not inherit her fear of the water. A fear born from her own first swim lesson at Girl Scout camp, a without warning drop into a murky, cold lake. That not-so-repressed memory came back as she settled herself into the parents' sitting area to see her little ones get introduced to the water. My sister recalls she had no breath to scream as she watched her kids flying through the air before hitting the water with a noisy splashdown. They immediately got comfortable kicking their legs, as the instructor knew they would. Both my niece and nephew are strong swimmers today. Mission accomplished for my non-swimming sister, who also knew most black kids can't swim. 64%, according to a joint study by the YMCA and YWCAs with the U.S. Swimming Foundation and the University of Memphis. That's one of the reasons there aren't a lot of black competitive swimmers and even fewer of Olympic caliber. Not enough potential talent in the pipeline. It doesn't help that the International Organization Swimming Federation, or FINA, banned a swim cap made by the British company Solcap, designed especially to cover black swimmers' afros, locks, and braids. Up until now, black swimmers have been forced to try to squeeze their hair into the much smaller cap designed for white hair, which grows straight and flat to the head. The company was inspired by Alice Deering, the first black woman to compete on the British Olympic swim team, who has a bushy afro. The larger cap does not enhance performance. In fact, experts note that it actually creates drag or resistance in the water. No matter. A little more than a week ago, FINA banned the cap's use because, according to the organization's culturally tone-deaf reason, the large swim cap did not fit the normal shape of the head. The casual racist comment was met with intense global backlash, followed by an announcement that FINA was reconsidering its ban. I didn't have much interest in Olympic swimming until Michael Phelps became the gold medal king. That's probably why I happened to be watching the 2016 Rio women's swimming competition in Brazil when the USA's Simone Manuel won. I was frankly surprised when her brown face popped up after touching the pool wall in victory. Manuel won gold, besting her competitors in the 100-meter freestyle race. Not only is Manuel the first African-American to win an individual gold medal in swimming, she also set both Olympic and American records. Her success is all the more amazing, since more than half of all African Americans can't swim, and they are also three times as likely to drown as whites, startling statistics directly tied to the nation's fraught history of segregated swimming pools. By custom and law, Black residents were denied use of the municipal public pools. The pools were permanently closed or shut down or drained and refilled if a Black person made it into the water. In 1964, a motel manager in St. Augustine, Florida, threw acid in a pool where five Black protesters had staged a swim-in. A photo of one of those screaming, shocked demonstrators, 17-year-old Mimi Jones of Roxbury, is an iconic image of the civil rights movement. After desegregation, Blacks who excelled in the sport had to figure out how to gain access to the private and pricey member-only clubs where swim meets are typically held. I wonder how many talented Black swimmers turned away from the sport because it was too hard to swim against the current of so many obstacles. But I also feel certain that Simone Manuel's very presence in the Olympic pool will be inspiring. This weekend, when the 2021 Summer Games kick off, I'll be watching, intentionally this time, hoping she can bring the gold home once again. Callie Crossley, GBH, Boston's local NPR.
Oh, say, Fred, have you heard the latest one about the Jew, the Catholic, and the colored boy who went to heaven?
Yeah, that's a doozy, Judge.
It reads like a DIY list of how not to organize the biggest sporting event of the year. The pandemic would have cast a pall over the best laid plans, but the delayed Tokyo 2020 Olympic Games have also been dogged by a spate of, to put it mildly, unhelpful self-induced PR disasters. In February, the head of the Games Organizing Committee was forced to step down after he was quoted as saying women talked too much. Just days ago, a composer quit the team creating the Games' opening ceremonies after it emerged that as a schoolboy he had bullied disabled classmates. And now, just a day before the opening ceremony, the man who had masterminded it, its creative director, Kentaro Kobayashi, has been sacked over footage of him joking about the Holocaust. The head of the Games Organizing Committee, Seiko Hashimoto, has apologized.
The production and ceremonies team's member, Mr. Kentaro Kobayashi, in his past work, he was actually making fun of the historical events in his production or in his comedy work. We're just a day before the opening ceremony, and to all of the people involved in these games, and also to the Japanese public, I'd like to extend my sincere apologies.
Organizers are already reassessing Friday's showpiece event. Rabbi Abraham Cooper from the Jewish human rights organization, the Simon Wiesenthal Center, says the Olympics organizers had little choice but to sack Mr. Kobayashi.
The Japanese Olympic Committee made the right decision, made all the more difficult because it comes literally on the eve of the opening ceremony. But when you have someone who's a veteran actor, had 22 years to consider his, changing his mind or at least apologizing for what happened, and additional comments apparently denigrating people with physical disabilities, there was just no other decision that could have been made.
Our sports news correspondent Alex Capstick talked me through the litany of errors that has blighted the run-up to the Tokyo Games.
Well, it's certainly terrible timing for the organisers, but as you say, Kentaro Kobayashi, the man in charge of Friday's opening ceremony, has been sacked, gone for what's been described as an anti-Semitic joke when he was a comedian back in the late 90s. This particular sketch took place in 1998 and involves him and a comedy partner in which he appears to mock the Holocaust. This clip was circulated online. It drew complaints. So Mr. Kobayashi was then asked to step down. He has apologised. He said the skit was inappropriate, that he was trying to grab people's attention and make them laugh in an inappropriate way. And as you heard there, Seiko Hashimoto, the president of Tokyo 2020, apologising for this. And she said that they should have checked people's backgrounds that are working on the opening ceremony. and they accept responsibility for not doing that.
These games have been jinxed. They appear to be plagued with all sorts of problems, you know, of course, COVID-19, but all sorts of other things as well.
Yes, and you have to feel sympathy for Seiko Hashimoto. She took over as head of the organising committee earlier this year, reluctant to take the post, replacing Yoshiro Mori, who resigned after saying that women talk too much during meetings. Since then, she's been forced to apologise for a series of gaffes and inappropriate behaviour from senior officials responsible for the ceremonies. In March, Mr. Kobayashi's former boss, Hiroshi Sasaki, he resigned after it emerged that he'd wanted an element of the show to include a popular female comedian, Naomi Watanabe, dressed up as a pig. And earlier this week, one of the musical directors, Keigo Ayamada, he quit after an interview which he gave in 1994. That was dug up. And in it, he confessed to bullying classmates at school who had mental disabilities. As a result, the musical element that's right at the top of the opening ceremony on Friday, which he composed, that's gone. And it now looks as though there will be other changes to the ceremony.
It won't be like an opening ceremony at the Olympics like any other.
It won't. It won't anyway, because there'll be no fans. There will be around about 1,000 VIPs, but bosses of big major sponsors from Toyota, Panasonic, Procter & Gamble in the States, they're not going to be there. They don't want to. They think it's inappropriate because of the public sentiment in Japan about the Games. The majority of the Japanese population don't want the Games because of the global pandemic. So, yes, a very different opening ceremony. But those plans have been thrown into chaos right now.
Alex Capstick.
Billie Holiday, I sing your blues. Bet your life against me and I swear to God you'll lose it. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis.
In St. Louis, two Catholic high schools are reckoning with an uneasy history linked to slavery. The high schools were named after prominent bishops who owned enslaved people. As the schools grapple with an appropriate response, students and parents are now weighing in. St. Louis Public Radio's Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson reports.
Rosalie Kane High School and Bishop DeBerg are prominent Catholic high schools here in St. Louis. Rosalie Kane was the first high school in St. Louis to integrate. Bishop DeBerg has notable graduates like Twitter co-founder Jack Dorsey. But what's significantly less known is that the bishops they're named after owned enslaved people. Madison Miles is a senior at Bishop DeBerg. She was surprised by the revelation.
We have been repping the school's name and motto since we've been there, and it's someone who wasn't a good person.
In 1822, Bishop DeBerg bought an enslaved couple and their children. A few years later, he transferred their ownership to Bishop Joseph Rosati, the first bishop of the Diocese of St. Louis. Ayanna Baldwin, Madison Miles' mom, says St. Louis has deep ties to slavery, but she's still disappointed.
You don't think to reach out to me, let me make sure that before I let my daughter go to this school and pay $900 a month, that the person who's the namesake is not some slave owner.
Bishop DeBerg and Rosati Kane are two of the latest Catholic institutions grappling with their history of slavery. Across the country, colleges and universities have been leading these efforts to put out the truth. There's a growing consortium of about 80 of them that study their legacies of slavery. That includes Georgetown University, which acknowledged that nearly 300 enslaved people were sold in 1838 to save the then-broke university from going under. The university went on to rename buildings after enslaved people. Loras College in Iowa removed a statue of its founder when it learned he owned enslaved people as well. But even with the universities leading the charge, the Catholic Church does not appear to have a clear blueprint to address its history with slavery. Kelly Schmidt is the research coordinator for the Jesuits Slavery History, Memory, and Reconciliation Project.
We're really on the cusp of a big turning point as the Catholic Church in the United States comes to address its histories of exploiting African Americans and Indigenous people and other marginalized groups.
Schmidt says as more universities establish working groups to explore their institutions' ties to slavery, many are sharing best practices, things like connecting with the descendants of enslaved people. It's unclear what Rosati Kane or Bishop DeBerg High School will do next. Neither school has informed students about this history, nor would comment for this story. Bishop DeBerg senior Madison Miles wants her school's name changed and a bigger investment in its Black students. But Ayanna Baldwin thinks a name change doesn't go far enough.
I want you to do action. So you speak action to me by having a scholarship fund for specific individuals so that our young Black men and young Black women can get a good Catholic education.
Tish Turner is a student at Rosati Kane. She wants her school to educate students and teachers about this uneasy history.
We can't change the past. So moving forward, it's important that we teach people about it, educate them so that it won't come as a shock to others.
While a spokeswoman for the Archdiocese of St. Louis declined an interview, she released a statement acknowledging that the schools are aware of the history. She says the Archdiocese wants to learn more and connect with descendants of enslaved people before deciding its next move. For NPR News, I'm Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson in St. Louis.
Hundreds of thousands of people are picking up the pieces from the worst natural disaster Germany has suffered in 60 years. Flooding in the region has left more than 180 people dead in Germany and Belgium, and many are still missing. NPR's Rob Schmitz spent the day in one of the worst-hit towns, and he joins us now. Good morning, Rob. First, tell us where you were and what you saw.
Yeah, I was in the town of Bad Neuenahr Ahrweiler. It's in a wine-growing region in the hills southwest of Bonn. Last week, the town received 2 months' worth of rain in just 2 days, and it's left the town looking like it's been bombed. Helicopters survey the damage from above. Huge stone bridges smashed in two, crushed cars tossed throughout the town. Random scraps of lumber, parts of houses, and uprooted trees line the streets, and all of it is covered in thick brown mud. This town is nearly 1,000 years old, and a small river called the Ahr splits it in half. The Ahr is really a creek, and it's typically only inches deep. But on Wednesday night, it rained so much that within a few hours, the creek rose by more than 20 feet, carrying debris that destroyed everything in its path. Claudia Krah remembers the sounds outside her home as she scrambled to the top floor.
The horrible sound of smashing cars and smashing glass, that was, I get goosebumps when I'm thinking about this. Yeah, the car smashed to the trees, and you hear the trees like knacking. And you said, okay, please, please, don't fall.
A few houses down from Krah, Martin Larson was taking a walk outside in the rain when he also heard strange sounds.
And then I heard the river, yeah? It was roaring, and that's not normal. And I heard logs from the river, trees, banging into the steel, yeah? Just bang, bang. A noise that I never heard before, and I said, okay, this is not normal.
Then he noticed water gushing out of the storm drains in front of his house, filling the street with mud. He drove his car to higher ground, ran back to the house where he and his wife woke up their three kids, and ran in their pajamas through the rising water from their house. That's when they realized they left his mother-in-law and his wife's grandmother inside their house next door. He says it all happened too fast.
We just got out of the way, yeah? We got out of the way. We knew she didn't get out. And the first half hour, there was communication over mobile phones. You could call her. Okay. Where are you? How are you doing? And she said, well, the water's coming, yeah? And then 15 minutes later, the last call we got was from her. She was standing on the second floor, screaming in panic in the mobile phone, saying, the water is coming. I'm going to drown. We're going to drown, yeah? And then it cut.
Electric lines and cell phone towers were suddenly down, cutting off families from each other. Dozens of people died in this village. Fortunately for Larson, his mother-in-law and his wife's grandmother survived by holding out on the third story of their home. A brown line just above the second floor of their house marks the high water line. Like everyone here, Larson is covered in mud, from his waders to his Cincinnati Bengals cap. Somebody's got to support this team, he jokes. And that's exactly the kind of spirit his coworkers brought to him.
We got some super help from my colleagues. Mm-hmm. I work 30 clicks from here. and they are not hit by the high water and the flooding. And they just, like, they told me the day after, yeah, we're coming, we'll help you. Yeah, so yesterday I had 40, 50 guys, men and women here, just helped me clearing out the whole house.
The town's streets are now lined with one-story-high piles of muddy sofas, dining room tables, broken windows, and beds. Friends and family pile it up, and bulldozers come to push it all aside. Down the street, Jens Karos has helped, too. He's got a team of friends with chisels pulling up his hardwood floor. He takes me on a tour of what used to be his downstairs living room, now filled with water.
When you take a look inside this room, you know how it looked everywhere else. There's nothing usable, nothing.
The room is piled to the ceiling with furniture, appliances, and mud. His backyard is filled with trees and random junk from upstream, too. And there are more tragic stories underneath all of this. It took two full days for his neighbor to discover a dead body under a pile of debris washed up against his backyard hedge. Karos is just happy his family is alive. His young children managed to sleep through this horrible disaster. They were safe and snug in their third floor bedroom.
Of course it was loud, but it was like a water. And maybe they find it interesting in their dreams or something like this. And we are really, really happy that they slept.
Claudia Kropp prefers to stay positive too.
You see, the positive things, we have a lot of nice people here helping us. We have a lot of more space now because all the things we have stored in our rooms.
All those things are now gone. And she says she's looking forward to starting over. And before I leave, she runs through the mud upstairs and emerges from her second-story window with a flag bearing her town's coat of arms, a cross and an eagle. She says it's a sign that this thousand-year-old town, no matter how bad it looks now, is still alive.
Rob, German Chancellor Angela Merkel made an official visit to the region yesterday. What did she have to say?
Well, she was reassured by how people and communities are sticking together. And she also mentioned the role of climate change in a tragedy like this. Here's what she said.
Man kann aus einem Ereignis.
She's saying here that you can't draw conclusions from one event, but that if you believe the science like she does, the sheer number of such extreme weather events that we've seen in Germany indicates that this has all to do with climate change.
And does the science bear that out?
Well, according to scientists here in Germany, it does. According to a recent study called the Global Climate Risk Index, Germany is among the top 20 countries in the world most impacted by climate change. And it's worth noting that before this region received 2 months' worth of rainfall in just 2 days, there was a years-long drought. Here's Fred Hatterman of the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research talking to German broadcaster RBB. And he's saying here that this year basically shows what can happen because of climate change. On one hand, we have a persistent drought and now all of a sudden very heavy rainfall, which can't be absorbed by the soil because it's too dry, and that leads to heavy flooding. And people in the town where I reported yesterday told me the same thing. They were all convinced that this disaster was related not only to climate change, but also to overdevelopment in the region. One man told me that the Ahr River had been engineered and manipulated from a winding, meandering waterway into almost a straightaway canal over years of development, and that this may also have played a part in worsening the floods.
And looking ahead just for the next few days, are these towns, can they start recovering, or is there any rain on the way?
Well, the rain's over for now, but the area's far from recovered. Residents told me that it'll be weeks before electricity is restored, months before they'll have gas. The region doesn't have clean drinking water, so the German military is sending convoys of water trucks to deal with that. But after spending a day in the disaster zone, it's clear that the military, fire crews, family, and friends are doing a very good job at cleaning up these devastated towns.
That's NPR's Rob Schmitz reporting from the worst-hit flood zones in western Germany. Rob, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Take a long bubble bath, let my feet hang out. We don't need no water. Drink it all up, then I'm peeing it out. We don't need no water. Let that motherfucker burn. Burn, 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 burn. We don't need no water. What you gonna do this weekend, Alice? Come by my palace. Baby, I got gallons. Una, 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 una.
As we've been hearing, the severe drought across the West is causing many problems. My colleagues and I recently went to the San Joaquin Valley in California, where this drought is threatening the drinking supply for thousands of rural residents, as well as the livelihoods for the farmers who grow a significant source of this country's food supply.
How much land is this?
On a dusty road in Madera, California, the temperatures will climb over 100 degrees today. Jaime Rivera's well has run dry.
It hasn't worked for like 3 weeks. And really, it hasn't worked for the last 2 years.
Across this parched state, many people living in rural areas can't connect to their local municipal water systems. They're too far away or they can't afford it. So they rely on their own private wells for water. But now, in this house that Rivera and his wife have lived in for 20 years, it's one they share with their daughters and their grandkids, nothing comes out of the tap.
Even though the house is fine, water is the thing you need most. It's indispensable for everything.
Getting water is now a daily chore. They fill barrels and old iced tea bottles at their jobs or their friends' places. And so all the things that most Americans take for granted, flushing the toilet, drinking, showering, doing the dishes, requires this new routine.
We do all this so we don't use too much water. This is the way we're living.
Amid this historic drought, the Riveras have turned to a local nonprofit for help.
They're panicking. They have kids. They need to provide water to their family.
Marlies Diaz works for Self-Help Enterprises. They set up a hotline for residents whose wells have run dry, and their phone has been ringing off the hook.
I mean, imagine a day waking up and you go to brush your teeth and there's no water. What do you do? I don't know, maybe you have a gallon of water at your sink, and so you just have to conserve your water and brush your teeth with a cup. It's like camping in your own home.
But this drought isn't just drying up small private wells. This area, the San Joaquin Valley, is one of the most important agricultural regions in America. Farmers here produce a bounty of food. There are miles and miles of nut and fruit trees across the valley, and millions of beef and dairy cows. Agriculture is an over $50 billion industry in California, and it's a thirsty one, using roughly half the state's total water supply.
And so all of that is, you know, affected by drought.
Ellen Hanek heads the Water Policy Center at the Public Policy Institute of California.
This is a region that has evolved with water scarcity. So growers have moved more and more into crops that generate more dollars per gallon of water used. And that means in that region more tree crops, like almonds especially, but you know, also vines and fruits. But it puts them in between a rock and a hard place when you get into a really bad drought.
In a good year, all the snow that falls in the Sierra Nevadas and rains in this area would end up in canals like this. There are thousands of these all over this valley, and farmers use that water to irrigate their crops. But in a drought like the one we're in right now, farmers have to dig hundreds of feet down into the ground to find other water. As more and more wells tap down into those underground aquifers and pull more and more water out of the ground, this resource is threatened. For most of the state's history, wells could draw an unlimited supply of water. But in 2014, the state passed a law to manage and, in some cases, restrict groundwater use. It hasn't gone fully into effect, but farmers in the region are worried. Some estimates say the law could put 1 million acres of farmland out of production. John Guthrie's family has been farming and ranching in this area for 150 years. He has never seen rainfall levels this low. Given the drought and the looming water restrictions, he says some farmers are getting out.
It's sure sad. I mean, they just don't figure they have enough water to farm what they have right now. It's just a real tumultuous time right now.
Has that feeling ever crossed your mind?
I can't say it hasn't crossed my mind. I don't think I would ever act on it. Mother Nature's our partner, so adversity is just kind of part of your deal. And, you know, we've been through a lot of previous challenges and stuff, and this just feels like another one of those. So,
you think you're going to weather this one?
Yeah, we will. Absolutely.
Absolutely. Guthrie, like a lot of farmers here, thinks the solution lies in doing a better job of capturing excess water in wet years.
The way we get out of this and the way that our forefathers intended it to be was surface water, storage, dams.
More dams along the rivers from north to south.
Yeah. Raise dams, build new dams, fix the infrastructure, the existing canals. The people of the state, or I should say the politicians, need to decide where do they want their food to come from.
But for now, with climate change exacerbating this drought, Ellen Hanick says farmers and residents alike still have to draw from those same underground water sources. And that competition leaves some people dry.
In places that have a lot of agriculture and that also have a lot of small rural communities, you get this situation where the groundwater is really being taxed, and the groundwater levels are falling, and the first wells to go dry are the shallow drinking water wells.
Cristobal Chavez's house in Porterville, California, is surrounded by agriculture. His well went dry for 6 months in 2014. He paid $20,000 to dig it deeper, but then he discovered another problem that's prevalent here, contamination. Tests revealed his well had four times the safe limit of nitrates, a potentially harmful chemical found in fertilizers and manure.
But you'd been drinking that water for years.
Yeah, that's the problem, because nobody tell you. We was drinking the water for 11 years without noticing that the water is contaminated.
So you find out that your water is not safe to drink. What do you do the very next day? What do you do?
We start buying it from the store.
But that's expensive.
Yeah, it is expensive, but it's more expensive if you get sick, you know. And
right.
It's kind of high, you know, but it's, we don't got another place to go.
Some studies have linked nitrates in drinking water to an increased risk of cancer. And last year, Cristobal's wife, Nora, was diagnosed with stomach cancer. But what caused it is unclear.
And there's no fix for that water in the well. Like the aquifer that your well goes down to, that's full of nitrates, and there's nothing they can do about that now.
No, nothing.
Back in Madeira, Jaime Rivera does have a solution, albeit a temporary one. Self-help enterprises helped get him this huge tank, and for the next year, it'll be filled weekly with fresh water. For nearly 4 hours, crews work to unload the tank, connect its pipes to the house, and fill it with a couple thousand gallons of water. So finally, after a long, dry spell.
Ahora sí.
Now, yes, the water is here.
And the first step for Rivera, call his wife.
We have water now. Fresh water came out of the faucet.
Wow, that's great. Thank you. Now you have to do the dishes.
We'll see if you cook tomorrow.
Rivera hopes one day to eventually dig his well deeper. But as this drought continues to worsen, it's not clear even that solution will be enough. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm William Brangham in California's San Joaquin Valley.
White supremacy is the sickness.
This week's news about life expectancy in the U.S. and how it dropped overall in 2020 echoes a sobering pattern that we saw all through the pandemic. Latino and Black people were hit the hardest. Life expectancy fell about 3 years for both groups compared to a 1.2-year drop for white people. We should note the CDC's data on this didn't include Asian Americans or other racial or ethnic groups. But overall, COVID-19 deaths played the largest role in the life expectancy drop. Dr. Alicia Fernandez at the University of California, San Francisco, has seen the impact on the Bay Area's Black and Brown communities firsthand. She studies what's called excess mortality across the state, and she joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you.
So can you just first set us up with some context here? I mean, what does it mean when life expectancy numbers drop like this? Like, this isn't something that happens often, right?
No, this is extraordinarily unusual, and it is very sobering and very upsetting because the United States has not seen a drop in life expectancy like this since World War II.
Wow.
This is an enormous drop in life expectancy and really reflects the toll that COVID has taken on the U.S. as a whole and on minority communities particularly.
And as we mentioned, you've been studying the deaths, or the excess mortality, as it's called, across California, and you found certain trends among Latinos. Can you tell us about those trends?
What we found is that among Latinos who died, Latinos who were immigrant were much more likely to die than Latinos who were U.S. native born.
Oh,
and Latinos with low levels of education were much more likely to die than those with higher levels of education. Mm-hmm. And then finally, people working in essential industries had excess death compared to Latinos that did not.
And those disparities, I mean, that's not just about COVID disproportionately affecting Latino communities. That's a portrait of the drastic inequalities that this pandemic laid bare, right?
I think what it indicates is who did COVID hit. And I think it points us, along with other studies, as to why. People who needed to work because they worked in healthcare, they worked in meatpacking industries, they were farm workers, they worked in all aspects of food production, and who couldn't stay home were much more likely to get sick.
Exactly.
And then, because immigrant Latinos tend to be poorer and tend to live in more crowded housing, they were more likely to bring home the infections and spread it to other people in their families, and then those folks got sick.
And let's just be clear, these patterns, these inequities that you were identifying, they've been known for quite some time. I mean, you spoke to NPR last year and noted how many Hispanic patients you were seeing very sick or dying from COVID, even as the San Francisco Bay Area was starting to flatten its COVID curve. And this was after many reports about the disproportionate impact the pandemic was having on Black and Latino people nationwide. So if these warnings came early on during the pandemic, where did you see missteps in the efforts to try to protect these vulnerable groups?
I think that we could have done much more as a society to make work safer. The other thing that could have been done would have been to ensure that people were able to stay home when they were feeling sick. As you know, lots of people with COVID, even if they're feeling somewhat ill, they'll continue to go to work if they don't have the financial reserves to be able to stay home and don't have paid sick leave.
So as the Delta variant continues to spread, what specifically do you want to see local, state, and federal officials do? And also these industries that were impacted, what do you want to see all of them focus on as this country moves forward, as the Delta variant keeps on spreading?
The biggest way to protect us all from the Delta variant is for everyone to be vaccinated. One of the things that all employers should be considering is whether or not a vaccine mandate makes sense in their industry. Mm-hmm. And while that is controversial for many workers, it will also protect the workers who choose to get vaccinated and choose to go to work. In addition, and most importantly, employers can really help by ensuring that everyone has access to reliable, nuanced information about the vaccine. There is so much misinformation out there that certainly large employers can play a role in that.
Dr. Alicia Fernandez, professor of medicine at UCSF and founding director of the university's Latinx Center of Excellence, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
This year, with the Juneteenth federal holiday and a greater national focus on the anniversary of the Tulsa Race Massacre, more Americans have been getting more familiar with the history of slavery and the amount of money plundered in that context from Black families over the centuries. Well, now, Reuters is reporting that the nation of Jamaica is preparing a petition to Queen Elizabeth for the UK to pay around $10 billion in reparations for some of the financial effects of slavery there. The UK ruled Jamaica in the colonial era. Independence only came in the 1960s. So what might reparations from the UK to Jamaicans look like? And could this process offer any kind of a model for the United States? With me now is Selwyn Cudjoe, professor of Africana Studies and Comparative Literature at Wellesley. He has been chair of the History of Ideas at Wellesley and, among other things, a director of the Central Bank of Trinidad and Tobago. Professor Cudjoe, we appreciate your time for this today. Welcome back to WNYC.
Well, Brian, thank you for having me back again. It's lovely to be on with you.
Can we use this opportunity to go over some history first that many listeners may not know, such as, we know 1619 in this country much better now as the year of the arrival of the first enslaved people, thanks to Nicole Hannah-Jones. Who brought the first enslaved people to Jamaica and when?
Well, certainly the British are the ones who brought them into Jamaica as part of their plans to sort of utilize the sugar industry to enhance their wealth in their country. As a matter of fact, a lot of the people in England lived off the profits from slavery. As a matter of fact, in 1776, 40 members of the British Parliament were making their money from the investments in the Caribbean. And of course, we can't forget Haiti, which of course was the richest country in the British in the Western Hemisphere. Not only inaugural brought an end in the slavery, but in fact, the people who in fact were being enslaved and being ripped off by the French, who had then paid him monies just to recognize their independence. Of course, remember Jefferson refused to do that about 1823. So it's been a long history. But in terms of Jamaica, I think they're coming into Jamaica was about around the 18th century.
And as a benchmark for paying reparations to descendants of enslaved people in Jamaica, and this is going to blow people's minds if they haven't heard it before, the Reuters story notes that the UK actually paid reparations to slaveholders to compensate them for their losses when the UK abolished slavery in Jamaica in 1834. Do you know that to be true?
Well, it is a fact, in point of fact, that they borrowed the money, I think, from the Rothschild Bank. It was about, I think, at that time, about 25% of the British, of the budget of Britain at the time, and they paid them very handsomely. I think they just finished paying in 2015. So the British the Parliament borrowed very heavily and paid the slave masters about £20 million, which would be about $100 billion today. In fact, for getting rid of, in compensation for their property. So we were never seen as people, we were seen as property. And in lieu of setting these enslaved people free, that of course Britain paid a tremendous amount of money. I think it must have been about a fifth of the national budget of Britain at the time. So yes, but of course we, and it is part of the petition that is being made, that we, the sons and daughters of slavery, never got a cent from that. Even poor Haiti was made to pay back the French for the question of recognizing their independence.
So listeners, Professor Cudjoe, go ahead. You want to make a point? Go ahead, sure.
I want to make one point, is that the notion that reparations should have been paid because none of us are directly descended from slaves and could trace their line is not entirely true. I am from Trinidad. I grew up on the estate, my family, of one of the biggest slaveholders in the Caribbean, William Hardin Burnley. I've just finished a book about 2 years ago on the slave master of Trinidad. And we lived on that plantation from the inception of 1834, my great-great-grandfather was born, and we could trace his lineage in that same village. So there's a direct connection in terms of our being ripped off and exploited by these masters. So just a personal note, you call for personal stories. In my book, The Slave Master of Trinidad, I sort of speak about that early slave master, who, of course, was one of the largest plantation. I grew up with a big house. Mm-hmm. In my very sight, every day. So sorry about that. But I thought what
no,
I
no,
could
and
add
I apologize
personal connection.
That I wasn't aware of your book to bring the title. So why don't you say it again? So now that people are getting to know you by this interview, they know what your book is?
My last book is called The Slave Master of Trinidad, William Hardin Burnley and the 19th Century Atlantic World. And he was one of the biggest slaveholders. He got some of the most money that was that Britain compensated in the British Caribbean, not just in Trinidad or Jamaica, but the entire Caribbean. So again, the book is The Slave Master of Trinidad, William Hardin Burnley and the 19th Century Atlantic World, published by University of Massachusetts Press.
Thank you. So who will decide on this claim? The Queen herself, Boris Johnson, someone else? Do you know?
Well, the Queen is just a figurehead. I mean, it's a question of the Parliament, UK Parliament. Now, they're willing to say, and of course, even the Queen or the Prime Minister, I think, when we spoke last time, I think it was Mayor Ben Cameron who had gone down there. They say, yes, we acknowledge, we're sorry. But nobody could say officially because that means that it makes you liable. So yes. The people who make that decision is the British Parliament. And they're the ones to decide. And of course, there have been large debates there, but no one is prepared to do that. One good example is what happens in terms of Namibia, where they put forward, I think Germany put forward $1.3 billion for the genocide that took place in Namibia over the years. In point of fact, about 1970 or so, 78, I interviewed Sam Nujoma, who was the former president of Namibia. And he had come to the United Nations Decolonization Committee to even begin to plead for freedom. At that time, they were under the direct hand of the Germans. And the Germans themselves, about, I think, sometime earlier this year, put out about $1.3 billion for what they called the harm that they had done. They were responsible for the colonial, they themselves acknowledged they were responsible for the colonial genocide that took place in that country. And they paid something like $1.3 billion in aid for the country, having that sum would serve as, quote unquote, a gesture of recognition for the immeasurable suffering the people of Namibia underwent. I think the British did the same thing in Kenya, when, for example, they had paid the descendants of the Mau Maus for what they'd done. So the legislature is the British Parliament are the ones who must do it. The Queen is simply a figurehead in all of this.
Yes.
California. A note now, our next story deals with subject matter that is not appropriate for all listeners. The state of California is trying to make amends with a cruel past. In the early to mid-1900s, the state forcibly sterilized tens of thousands of women and men as part of a state eugenics program. The state banned those forced sterilizations in 1979, but the Center for Investigative Reporting found that between 2006 and 2010, the state sterilized nearly 150 incarcerated women without required state approvals. Now, Governor Gavin Newsom has signed into law a provision that would provide an estimated $25,000 in reparations to each of the hundreds of living survivors of those sterilizations. Kelly Dillon is one of those survivors, and she joins us now. Welcome.
Hello.
Hi. Thank you for being with us. Now, I know that you have been fighting for justice and redress for more than a decade now, and I'm just wondering, how does it feel now that this reparations legislation has passed?
Yes, I feel grateful and I feel relieved because it's been for over 20 years that we have been fighting. And for some of the other survivors, it's been over 40 years. So I'm relieved that we're at a place to be able to move forward in the healing that we have been looking for.
And can you explain exactly how this reparations program would work?
Yeah, so reparations program through the budget is broke down into three different parts. The first part being that California will provide memorial monuments in areas throughout the state of California that represent over 25,000 sterilized survivors through the program. The second part of it is that a portion of that, the funding, will go back to California to create a public health committee that will actually be in charge of the notification process and looking to see how they can find the eligibility for survivors. And then the third piece will go towards the actual compensation.
I want to talk a little bit about your own story. Can you tell us, how did you find out you were sterilized? Because I understand you were still incarcerated at the time when you realized what had happened to you.
Yes, I was incarcerated at the time, and I was 24 years old when I had undergone a surgery that was an abdominal surgery that was a simple procedure to check for cervical cancer and as well as address some possible cysts that may have been on the outside of my uterus. And so that was the surgery in which I consented to, in which I was told it was a simple procedure. But afterwards, I began to experience so many like strange symptoms, in which I now know that they were symptoms of menopause and hormonal changes. And so after numerous complaints, numerous requests to speak to a physician or to either follow up with the surgeon, I was constantly denied and I was given the runaround. And so that caused me to actually reach out to an agency who was doing some social justice work inside of women's prisons around medical health care. And Cynthia Chandler, who was an attorney and also the executive director of Justice Now at the time, came back to speak with me. And so from there, she helped me to advocate and actually provided the funding that was necessary to retrieve my medical records. And that's how I found out, which was like a year or so later.
And eventually, after you discovered the magnitude of what had happened to you, you eventually began gathering the stories of other women in that correctional facility. Can you tell us, what did you find?
Yeah, so we began to discover that a lot of young women between of the childbearing ages of at least about 24 to about 35 were having these surgeries at alarming high rates. And so, it allowed us, with the findings we had, to open up an investigation.
Horrendous. What do you think is next for these survivors? I mean, do you think this fight for accountability ends with these reparations of $25,000 per individual?
Oh, no. No. The fight for reproductive justice and reparations does not end with just the distribution of this funds, but it is a step towards it. What we have been doing, all coalition agencies that are involved, we have begun to do education, understanding the history of eugenics, understanding what sterilization practices and what they look like and how they show up in other institutions, and also understanding what these policies are and, you know, and that are put in place for population control.
Kelly Dillon is a survivor of California's forced sterilizations in prisons. Thank you very much for taking the time to share your story with us today.
Thank you so much for inviting me and for your interest in the story and allowing your listeners to learn about the history of eugenics.
We gotta go back. When he said why, I said we gotta go, 'cause I left my wallet in El Segundo. Yeah, I left my wallet in El Segundo. Left my wallet in El Segundo. Left my wallet in El Segundo. I gotta get it, I got to get it. Left my wallet in El Segundo. Left my wallet in El Segundo. Left my wallet in El Segundo. Come on, let's go.
As Cole Sternberg dreams of the utopian republic of tomorrow, nearby residents are speaking out about the harsh realities of today and yesterday. El Segundo, an oceanside city of roughly 16,000 people just south of LAX, is overwhelmingly white. And now a group called El Segundo for Black Lives is confronting what it says is the city's racist legacy.
Racism does land on the body.
The substitute teacher had suspected I'd been high or had smoked weed before class.
What happened to us on August 30th was the first time for me personally that I've been attacked for my race.
Even though I'm not doing anything, even though I'm not speeding, I still think back to all the felony stops and all the times that I've had guns drawn on me.
They said, I think we should go by your middle name, which is Dolly. because it's a little bit more appropriate for our company.
For the police to come knock on my door was just another level of blatant racism. And that really broke my soul.
A new documentary called Black in Mayberry tells the personal stories of more than a dozen black residents of El Segundo, including Violet Gonzalez-Baird, who joins me right now, along with the producer of the documentary, Tanya Taylor. Welcome to you both.
Hi. Thank you for having us.
Hello.
Tanya, I'm going to start with you, because why the title Black in Mayberry? What is the story behind the name? I know what Mayberry is. It's from the Andy Griffith Show, right?
That's correct. And you know that the show and El Segundo itself has a reputation for being practically all white and being this idyllic, by-the-sea, quaint little town where everything's all fluffy bunnies and butterflies. It's never been a place where a space has been provided or recognition for black residents has been provided. So to put the word black in front of Mayberry is actually quite a contrast. It may as well be black and white together.
El Segundo is 72% white, according to the 2019 census, but that number used to be even bigger. So talk a little bit, Tanya, about the history that led to the city's demographics.
So El Segundo was once a sundown town, and for those who do not know what a sundown town is, it's a city or a place where people of color, generally at the time, black people were made to know that they were not welcome in the city after dark. El Segundo had a lot of black people working at Chevron. However, despite the fact that they were working pretty much in the city, they were not permitted to have either residence here or to be here after dark. We were made aware that there used to be a welcome sign that said, you know, no blacks.
Mm. When did you move to El Segundo, Tanya? And did you notice right away that it was so white?
We moved here in 2020. I can't say that I noticed that it was so white. Being somebody who grew up in the UK, I'm very much accustomed to being one of very few black people. What struck me more was the fact that people wanted it to stay white. Having been a part of El Segundo for Black Lives and organizing and joining the protests with that group, it was shocking to me how many people were frustrated at the fact that anyone wanted to mention the word black in El Segundo. They wanted it to stay this Mayberry, seaside, all-white, quaint little town.
As I mentioned, you interviewed more than a dozen people who told their own personal stories. These are sort of vignettes that surrounds race and racism in El Segundo. And one of them was Violet. And Violet, we'll get to you in a second. I want to hear what you had to say in the film.
There are so many people who like to joke about people like George Floyd and Jacob Blake. Like literally today, I was walking past like these group of boys in my grade, and they were like, yo, Violet, have you seen the video of the protesters getting shot? Yeah, that was funny. And I was like, oh, okay. I feel like personally it's my job to educate people on all the world issues. And it's like, I sometimes have to tell myself to like stop, because I'm like, you're only 13.
What do you try to say or do, Violet, when you hear a racist remark like that or experience some sort of aggression or microaggression?
Well, I don't know. When I hear like racist comments, I try my hardest to compose myself and not like go absolutely crazy. But I try to just correct people and be like, hey, that is not all right. You shouldn't be saying stuff about people who have done absolutely nothing to you.
Do you agree with Tanya that people around you want to keep El Segundo how it is or how it's been?
Probably. I wouldn't be surprised, especially because a lot of old people do live here. So, but in my experience with the people of El Segundo, I think I just know a lot of more progressive people who want El Segundo to be more diverse and to actually work on the racism that happens in this town. But I do agree with Tanya that there are definitely a lot of people who want to keep El Segundo the way it was.
You and your mom were both interviewed separately, by the way, for this project. What was it like sharing your own experience and then your mom sharing hers?
Yeah, it was interesting. to like see my mom get emotional and upset over the racism that she's experienced, because I don't really get to see her be like that, especially when it comes to racism, because she doesn't talk about it a lot, but there are times when she will. It's like very cathartic, I guess, because I was like, this is a society that we live in.
I want to play another clip, Tanya, from a man named Wendell.
Especially now with everything that's coming out and everything that's kind of being torn open, it's kind of like the Band-Aid is being ripped off and you're seeing the wound for the first time, a wound that I was blind to, a wound that I'm starting to get a sense of, and I, quite frankly, it's leaving me drained, you know? Now I'm starting to question if something was a microaggression or not. I never questioned that before, and now it's starting to seep in.
I think a lot of white people, Tanya, started seeing that wound for the first time with the death of George Floyd, the murder of George Floyd on the street of Minneapolis. And it's interesting that a black man like Wendell is too. I mean, what was your reaction to what he had to say?
To your point, with the murder of George Floyd, I think a lot of people began to rethink their experiences. Now, one of the things I want to make very clear is that, just as Violet mentioned, her mother doesn't speak to her. It's not like her mother speaks to her every day about race and the racism she experiences. And most of the time, we're trying to escape that nightmare. So we try to live in a world where we don't have to think of ourselves through the lens of racism. And I think Wendell is one of those people who has pushed to not permit racism to limit his experiences in life. However, if he does look closely, if we all look closely, moments that happen to someone like George Floyd or Breonna Taylor does make you rethink the type of society that you're living in. And it makes you rethink things that you thought were once innocent that may not have been so innocent.
Violet, as you continue to grow up in El Segundo, what do you want for your city? What are the things that you want, and what do you tell your classmates?
I just want El Segundo to grow. And like, what I really want is for people to start understanding each other and to listen and to understand that there are real things going on in the world. And just because you don't acknowledge them, it doesn't mean that they're fake or they're not really going on.
I want to thank you both. Again, it's a powerful documentary. Violet Gonzalez Baird, who stars in the film Black and Mayberry, which was, by the way, produced by Tanya Taylor. Thanks to you both.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You can watch the film for free online at blackinmayberry.com.
We consciously determine that we are not going to play with sex so that the joke is on the offspring. See, sex may be highly enjoyable, but it's not to be demeaned and degraded, so we end up producing throwaway children and creating the worst crime second to white supremacy on the planet, meaning the mistreatment of children and not taking care of the children that we produce. So they get thrown away to a foster care system, and they get sexually abused. If they don't get sexually abused at home, they get sexually abused in the foster care and moving from one house to another. Like I talked to one child, told me she'd been in 15 different foster homes.
How do you keep children safe when a parent is surviving domestic violence? And are foster parents scrutinized as much as birth parents are when it comes to the well-being of these children? These are just some of the very difficult decisions facing the child welfare system almost every day. And these decisions disproportionately impact Black, Latino, and Native American families. Reporter Deepa Fernandez has been investigating foster care deaths in L.A. County. I spoke with her about her audio documentary for Latino USA called Unsafe in Foster Care. And just a warning for listeners, this conversation does include details about cases of domestic and child abuse. Deepa Fernandez, welcome.
Thank you, Elsa.
So Deepa, I just want to start from the very beginning. Your documentary follows the story of Leah Garcia. She's a mother of two. Can you just tell us a little bit about her and how her son, Joseph Chacon, ends up in the foster care system?
Sure. You know, Leah Garcia is in some ways not any different to many of us mothers. She has a daughter who she adores. She's a very playful mother. She has a second child, Joseph. And at this point, she is with Joseph's father. And this partner starts to get abusive. And it's not something Leah has ever experienced in her life. And she describes it as the abuse just kind of crept up on her.
I feel like he, like, eased into the way he treated me. I feel like when people, like, slowly ease into treating you a certain type of way, they kind of manipulate you a lot. And I feel like that's what happened.
When the abuse got bad, she called the police. But that's really where she came into the crosshairs of the Department of Children and Family Services here in LA County, DCFS as it's known. If police or teachers or welfare workers see what they believe is abuse or neglect, and in this case, if children are present during an incident of domestic violence and the police are called, they're required to notify DCFS.
Right. And then the child welfare system determined that there was a failure to protect Joseph. And that is why he was eventually removed and placed into the foster care system.
You know, when you look at it from the perspective of the child welfare authorities, they really have to take care of children. Domestic violence can get very dangerous.
Well, then I'm curious, when do kids get to stay with a parent when that parent is being abused in a relationship?
I think the only cases where that happens, Elsa, is when social workers deem that the parent who is the survivor, who is not doing anything to hurt her children, actually has a safety plan. Mm-hmm. You know, the restraining order is really a big one. Sometimes women don't actually understand, as one of the attorneys in the story said, it's the gold standard. Get yourself a restraining order. That shows to us that you're protecting your child. But how you actually do that is complicated, and you have to figure all of that out on your own.
And unfortunately, the tragedy here is that Joseph ends up dying while he is in the care of the foster care system. And what you found, unexpectedly, was a story about another child, Draco Ford, a baby who died in the custody of this same foster family. Can you just very briefly tell us about what happened to Draco?
So Draco Ford was removed from his mother when he was just over a month old, and he was placed with the same foster family where Joseph was and ended up dying. And, you know, I got the 911 calls. I asked for them all from the residence where Joseph mm-hmm. died. And it was so shocking to get two 911 calls and hear that it was also for a foster baby. And then to see in the autopsy that a second baby had died. And, you know, all we really could go on was that this little baby, it appeared, had died of sudden infant death syndrome, or SIDS. He was found unresponsive in his crib by the foster mother.
And how did the agency here, the Los Angeles County Department of Children and Family Services, or DCFS for short, how did they explain what happened in the deaths of Joseph Chacon and Draco Ford?
You know, DCFS was very responsive to all my requests. They were very quickly able to provide me with numbers. They would not talk about any particular case. They are bound by privacy laws. What they could tell me was what their protocol is. So say there is a death in a foster home of a foster child, or there is an injury. They err on the side, let's just take those children out of that home and place them somewhere else while we determine what happened. Unfortunately, what I found that happened in this case, Elsa, was that a decision was made very quickly that this was a SIDS death and that it wasn't the caregiver's fault at all, so that the rest of the children could remain in her care. And I think that's where some scrutiny is required. Foster parents are put through a very rigorous screening upfront. I think what may not stand up to so much scrutiny is whether foster parents, once they have the children, I'm not sure that that same scrutiny holds up when social workers have such high caseloads.
We also mentioned that a disproportionate number of the kids who are in foster care are Black, Latinx, or Native American. Can you just tell us briefly, why is that?
Elsa, the reality is it's been like that for decades. But what is new is that it's not changing. And today we are well aware of these largely disproportionate numbers. One might say that it starts by the people who call in with reports of child abuse. And once there is a report of child abuse, then the system kicks into gear to decide, should we go out and investigate that? And a lot of those calls disproportionately are about Black and Latino and Native American children here in LA County.
Right. I mean, you find that in many cases, families are being penalized for simply being poor, right?
And that's one of the big factors here. Poverty is a really big factor. You know, often to some social workers, poverty might look like neglect.
Yeah.
DCFS will say, well, we're training our social workers. We're putting them through anti-bias and cultural awareness trainings. But is it enough?
Right. Well, then you end this documentary with a voice from outside of California, a mother in New York, who's calling for the whole child welfare system to be abolished altogether.
What would it look like if we instead supported the family who we said was not rising to a level that we wish they would rise to in caring for their child? If they didn't lack a coat because instead of giving money to a foster parent, you bought a damn coat or you bought a bag of groceries, even if you had to do that consistently for a moment.
Tell us more about that point of view.
There was a call that I was seeing and hearing about to abolish child protective services. You know, I think this movement of mothers, and it is mothers, in New York City took inspiration to say, you know, maybe in some cases, and in many cases, this is not working. Why are we keeping on doing the same thing? The solution might be to actually not take children at all, but to find other ways of intervening and providing support.
That was Deepa Fernandez. She reported Unsafe in Foster Care for the public radio show and podcast Latino USA.
This the city of Chicago. Chicago.
88 people are demanding that their drug convictions be thrown out, saying they were framed by a former Chicago cop convicted of corruption. A petition filed today asking for their cases to be exonerated so that they can go on with their lives.
We came here today because this is where it's happened.
Dozens of residents of the now demolished Ida B. Wells homes on the city's south side say they were terrorized for 10 years, beginning in 2002 by former CPD Sergeant Ronald Watts.
I'm just trying to get my life back together. I have five children that I have to provide for. And with this over my background, it's kind of hard for me to get the job that I need.
Sergeant Ronald Watts was a criminal. He went to prison and he spent a decade allegedly patrolling the area with a corrupt tactical team. But what he was really doing was facilitating his own drug trade, his own gun trade, and planting cases on anyone and anyone and everyone who got in his way.
All 88 petitioners have served their time, but they want their records cleared.
The time when Watts kicked in my door, I didn't have no money for no attorney. So all I can do was, you know, go to court and then end up in the penitentiary. And I never get that time back.
Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox has been investigating some of these exoneration requests for 3 years, others for 1 year.
What the state's attorney has told us and has said publicly is we're reviewing them. And it's our position that they've had enough time to review them.
109 drug cases connected to Watts have already been vacated during the past 5 years.
Hoping our 10 volumes of evidence, our 90-page petition, will finally achieve a level of justice for so many of those individuals that it's eluded so far.
Ronald Watts spent a year and a half in prison after he and another officer in his unit pleaded guilty back in 2013. There is still an ongoing CPD internal investigation into other officers associated with Watts who are still on the force.
The punishment is capital.
Now to a milestone in the investigation into the attack on the U.S. Capitol. Today, in federal court in Washington, D.C., a Florida man who entered the floor of the Senate during the January 6th riot was sentenced to 8 months in prison. He becomes the first defendant to be sentenced for a felony plea in the investigation. NPR Justice correspondent Ryan Lucas was at the courthouse. Hey, Ryan.
Hi there.
So I know most of the court hearings here in Washington for defendants in the Capitol riot have been done virtually. This one was in person. Paint us a picture of what it was like today in court.
Well, there was a small bank of TV cameras outside the entrance to the courthouse, but otherwise it was pretty quiet. People are still wearing masks in court here in D.C., and social distancing still very much applies. They've even set up glass partitions in the courtroom to separate people because of COVID. And as you said, almost all of these Capitol riot hearings have been done virtually. But Paul Hodgkins, the defendant in this case, was in court today for his sentencing. He was dressed in a dark suit with a striped tie, and he had his long hair pulled back into a ponytail.
And what else do we know about Paul Hodgkins?
He's a crane operator from Florida. He took a bus from Tampa to Washington for January 6th to show his support for Donald Trump. On that day, he walked from the rally near the White House to the Capitol. He entered the building after the doors had already been bashed in by others. And he ultimately made his way through the halls of the Capitol and onto the floor of the Senate, carrying a big red Trump 2020 flag with him. He was among the first of the January 6th defendants to plead guilty. In his case, he pleaded guilty to one felony count of obstructing an official proceeding. He was not accused of violence or destroying property. He did speak in court today. He said he was truly remorseful and regretful for what he did on January 6th. He said, quote, "I say this not because I face consequence, but because of the damage that day's incident caused, the way this country that I love has been hurt." He said it was a, quote, "foolish decision," and that he takes full responsibility for it.
Interesting. All right. So to his sentence, 8 months in prison, what did the judge say about how he came to that conclusion?
Well, the judge in this case, Randolph Moss, said he had a lot to consider. This is, as you noted, the first felony case to go to sentencing from the Capitol riot. And there isn't really anything similar in American history before this to look back to as a precedent. Judge Moss said what happened on January 6th was horrific, and it did profound damage to the country's democracy. And he said it is essential to send a message that the rioters' actions are unacceptable. But at the same time, he's sentencing only Paul Hodgkins for his actions. And Moss said he thinks Hodgkins made some very bad decisions on January 6th, but he doesn't think that Hodgkins poses a threat in the future. He noted that Hodgkins did not previously have a criminal record. He didn't act violently on January 6th. He didn't destroy property. And so the judge came down on 8 months in prison and 2 years of supervised release, which the judge said he thought was a fair sentence.
Is this sentence a likely blueprint for other defendants for January 6th charges?
Well, from talking to defense attorneys, the sense is that this is laying the foundations. We've already seen one defendant sentenced for a misdemeanor plea from January 6th. She received 3 years of probation. Now we have Hodgkins getting 8 months for a nonviolent felony. The Justice Department with Hodgkins had asked for 18 months. We have yet to see, though, sentencing for a capital defendant charged with violence or conspiracy. And those people may very well face much longer sentences.
Thank you, Ryan.
Thank you.
NPR's Ryan Lucas.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, July 24, 2021. So I have been told our weekly compensatory call-in, dial in. If you have suggestions, questions, comments, the number 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Few things before we get to the callers. One, we will be here on Monday, normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. White guests only. Amy Schmidt should be with us 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We'll discuss her book, Right of Way, which talks about the staggering number of pedestrian deaths in the U.S. and why disproportionately. It is black people and even a teaspoon of black male privilege, disproportionately colored males who end up dying, walking the sidewalk, trying to cross the street, just being a law-abiding pedestrian. We'll talk about why that is Monday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, and my favorite city, Seattle, is mentioned regularly in the text as an example of the proper way to design cities for the safety of pedestrians. Best plantation easily in the U.S. Easily. Invest if you think Decals is constructive. racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you hit the blog, PayPal button is in the top right corner. Much obliged to all the folks who have contributed. Help Decals remain on air for a dozen years. Cash App is also listed. We are at cash.app/$Decals. Again, tremendous appreciation for all the folks who have contributed to the cows over the years. You can also nab an item from our wish list at Amazon.com, listed under Gus T. Renegade. I hope the program has been, continues to be, worthy of your time and energy. Getting to some, in fact, even before I get to one of the clips, I'll get it in before I forget. I think it was last week, caller in Florida, he was talking about the word unvaccinated and saying he was paying attention to how that word is being used in news reports, that sort of thing, and saying, what do they mean? What feeling are they trying to evoke when they start talking about unvaccinated? So this article, I saw it earlier today. This is from Yahoo News. It reads, patience has worn thin. Frustration mounts over vaccine holdouts. 7 months after the first coronavirus shots were rolled out, vaccinated Americans, I thought that was interesting too, vaccinated Americans, including government, business, and health leaders, are growing frustrated that tens of millions of people are still refusing to get them, endangering themselves and their communities, and fueling the virus's spread. Alabama Governor Kay Ivey, a Republican, on Thursday lashed out amid a surge of cases in her state, telling a reporter, it's time to start blaming the unvaccinated folks. Now I said, whoa. Put a pin in that one. It is time to start blaming the unvaccinated folks. Yikes. If somebody has to be blamed, that means there might be some culpability. Ooh. For these unvaccinated folks. The NFL this week imposed new rules that put pressure on unvaccinated players, warning their teams could face fines or be forced to forfeit games if those players were linked to outbreaks. I'll stop there, but that one caught my attention, like, wow, very different change of tone. Unvaccinated folks, let's start assigning blame. Yikes. All right, so now we can get back to the audio clips. Let's see. So they started off, they were talking about the census. Having this non-white person in a position that has been dominated by white people, no kidding. Racial classification is very important. Keep all that confusion going. They said going back to 1790, dominated by white people, and they said the lack of diversity has long been a concern for some inside the bureau. I said, stop right there. Same way that we talk about Randall Sullivan's labyrinth, you got to show me some evidence that a so-called lack of diversity, meaning you don't have any non-white people hired to work here, that that's been a concern. Same way that I ask that question, white people are sincerely and greatly pained by racism. Like, really? How did they articulate their concern? Did they write a letter? Did they protest? Did they take a knee during a luncheon? Tell me what they did to articulate their concern about the lack of Negroes who helped put together the U.S. Census. Then they said there was no reason to question that on one side of the table, because this is the way it's always been. It's not about questioning, it's this is the way we want it to be, same way you heard in El Segundo. It's not about questioning, this is what we want. We know the power of the racial classifications in the census. We don't need any Negroes here. Bring them in to, you know, be custodians, maybe clean the toilet, that's about it. Make coffee. Let's see. We heard the segment, or I guess two segments, on so-called climate change, the flooding in Europe. More than 100 people perished. And then in California, the droughts, California, not that far from where I am in Seattle, Washington. I mentioned it last week. Like, wow, I'm not sure. I know everyone listening to the cows does not believe in so-called climate change, and that's fine. You don't have to. But just, wow, with the number of weather events, gusty heat wave here in Seattle, and they had another heat wave in this, what they call a heat wave in this area, and then the droughts in California, and the flooding in Europe, like, could be. That might be contributing to ending racism, white supremacy. Again, Dr. Marimba Ani Inyarugu, she said, hey, they poison the whole planet. Might be other entities that are tired of racism, white supremacy. Sounded like in California it was some non-white people who were suffering from the lack of water problem here in Washington State as well. Water drought and all. Let's see. Now, even within that now, when they talked about Germany and the flooding, they said everything covered with this brown mud. Like, wow, is that a Welsing moment? But even with all of that, they did mention at the end the Germanic efficiency. The bulldozers were coming in to put it all in piles so they could take all this garbage out. Family, military, mobilized to make sure that they have fresh drinking water and all the rest of it. Like, I remember when we read Gary Rivlin's Katrina after the flood. A lot of the white people in areas that did flood, yep, had to start from scratch. Or with the, as they say, we had to tear down the whole house, build it anew. Rivlin said that after 10 years, some of those areas look better than they did before. Wouldn't be surprised if that happened in Germany as well. They said in this town that's like 1,000 years old, they said their sign was an eagle and the cross. I said, why isn't that in the ISIS papers? In Hawk Signal Walker, in this sign, we conquer the religion of white supremacy. You know, white Jesus. Yes, he will see us through. Let's see. Wow. Metaphors were all over. The segment where they began talking about white supremacy, racism, before I get to that. So they talked about the reparations both in Jamaica. They talked about reparations for the victims of the forced sterilization program in California. We've talked about the latter extensively. I've even had guests on the program repeatedly to talk about forced sterilizations in North Carolina, Virginia, a number of states in the U.S. Where this was common practice, and particularly making sure we go out eventually and get lots, as many black people as we can, even though there were white people that were sterilized as well in this program. Males and females also, important to add that in. Let's see. The book, Solon R. Cudjoe, The Slave Master of Trinidad, William Hardin Burnley, and the 19th Century Atlantic World, Reading More Important Than Watching Television. Might be an interesting compare and contrast between the two. The $25,000 for the victims in California, I thought, was kind of cheap, especially when you hear from some of the victims, black female, on talking about her experience. You go in for a routine stomach issue, and they have sterilized you, and then you're having all these hormonal changes, menopause, she later, you know, was able to deduce. And you're not able to figure it out. And you go in and they say, we're just going to give her the runaround. And then you sit around and wonder, now, how did I get this stomach cancer? Is it from all the chemicals they dumped in the water? Or is it from them giving me the runaround? Then we get to the segment on El Segundo in California, waterfront community, sundown town. Even before they use that language, that's another metaphor, an area where they exclude the Negros, black people in particular. We read that sundown town way back a few years on the Cowles Book Club, Reading More Important Than Watching Television. They said in the sundown town that the black people were not welcome here. I said that's one way of saying it. Another way of saying it is, hey, this legacy of sundown towns meant that often they would have a billboard posted outside the town that said, read nigger or run. And if you can't read, run. And a variety of colorful phrasings like that that generally mean nigger, run. Remember, they told us they had the bands of children, white children, who would go around and organize and make sure that no Negroes come in. They would get their slingshots. They had creative words even for the slingshot, Negro rifles and all the rest of this, to go around and make sure that the Negroes obeyed the curfew, if you want to call it that. But the minimizing of what all this was about, and that most of these were outside the South, these so-called sundown towns. Anywho, when they continue El Segundo in that segment, and they had the young lady on, she's only 13 years old, Violet Gonzalez Baird, and she said she's talking about being in school here, and these little white urchins, they go around and are mocking the death of George Floyd. Now I said, man, doesn't that fool on here talk about racist jokes all the time? Doesn't Neely Fuller Jr., victim of racism, doesn't he say, hey, by the time 15, now they said 13. Now, it could be that these little urchins are, you know, advanced. Or it could be Mr. Fuller, you know, he was a little too late. You know, he could have moved his age schedule. He could have moved it back. They don't have to wait till 15. Could be 11. Could be 10. Could be 9. Could be 8. I would say at minimum by 13, they got it. According to what we, if they're mocking the death of George Floyd and the protesters, they got it. The little victim, Violet Gonzalez Baird, she says, I see it as my job to educate. Again, that framework. This is not a problem of these little 13-year-old race soldiers are ignorant, that they don't understand racism, they don't understand what's incorrect about what they're saying. You don't understand. We don't understand what it means to be white. A white child, a white woman, a white man. We are still learning. Also in that same segment, Violet Gonzalez Baird, she said that, I guess for this documentary, they interviewed her mother as well. She said that her mom doesn't really talk about racism all the time. She'll mention it every now and then, but to see her mom talking about this and getting emotional like that was really significant for her. Hey, Gus T does not have children. All of that said, speak with your children about racism. This young lady is 13 years old. She's already having to deal with racism. It's nothing that you're saying. If you're thinking is, well, I want to protect my child from all that and I don't want to have these conversations, too late. They're probably being called a nigger at school already, or their friends are, or whatever. A variety of different incidents. Just the way that you explain to your children about fire. We heard the segment about black children not being able to swim. We heard all about that. That's Richard Williams. Didn't he have the story about that? We've heard so many of them over the years. But the same way that you teach your children about water safety, about fire safety, about safety for child rapists, you got to talk to them about racism, white supremacy. No 13-year-old black girl, no 13-year-old black boy should be saying, you know, it's not too regular for dad, mom to be chatting it up about race. That didn't, you know, happen in our house too much. It has to be something really wild happened, like they had to choked out George Floyd on TV or something. Then it might come up, and maybe somebody called him a nigger on the job. But generally, we are talking about other things. Like, no, as an attempted counter-racist parent, got to do better. I think Thomas in New York said his children, oh, God, your dad goes, he's always talking about white people and this racism thing. That's much closer to what we have. Let's see. Even within all of that, microaggressions, the words that were used to describe all of this and the metaphors, it was like having the Band-Aid ripped off. Experiencing that nightmare. I don't know what that means. The Band-Aid ripped off and all the rest of it. We're talking about the system of white supremacy, racism. And again, these little 13-year-old white children, they're not ignorant. It's not, they don't need to read Ta-Nehisi Coates to grasp what's wrong about them joking about George Floyd. This is what they've heard their parents and uncles and aunts and grandparents and all doing for years. So they got it. There's a reason El Segundo has been that way for years. And they're making it plain. We want it to stay this way. We're not interested in seeing it change. No Negros. Put the sign back up. Anywho, many other comments we could share. We will get to the listeners, callers. Number again is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. For this broadcast, I request if we could not use metaphors. There were a bunch of Band-Aid ripped off and that nightmare that won't go away. Sundown Towns is even a metaphor. Give you the runaround. And because I feel like something like that, as opposed to saying, man, they sterilized me against my will without consent or even, you know, letting me know after the fact. And then when I'm having health complications as a result of this and I go back to talk to them, I don't say they gave me the runaround. They obfuscated and deliberately deceived me about these procedures. Engaged in subversive activity. That totally different impact. Dr. Welsing's metaphor, your brain computer processes those two sentences in a very different manner. Gave me the runaround. No metaphors, por favor. I will prompt about that. Let's make an effort to be direct, precise, clear, exact. We could take about 5 minutes to share our thoughts, observations. That would be spectacular. Much obliged. To make sure everyone gets at least one chance to speak. If you know you're in a noisy environment, if you could use your mute button, that would be great. Just you can unmute, share your thoughts, observations, and then once you're done, you can mute your line. If you have additional thoughts, questions, no problem. You can just unmute, maybe get to a quieter area, maybe, just so we don't have to compete with a lot of unnecessary background noise. Let's see. Number 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. First few folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Hello.
I heard both of you. Let's get Irie.
First, Mia.
Okay. See, I was right there with you. Irie in Louisiana. Yes, ma'am.
Gratitude. I'm trying to make it very short. It's been a while since I've been able to tune in live, so this was really interesting. Did anybody else catch what the female victim of racism said about her procedure? She said she went in for a possible cyst and some other possibility. So there was nothing proven. Like, I'm wondering, how did she even get to the point where they said, yeah, you need this procedure? Like, did she even have any scans or x-rays to show that? I find the whole thing highly criminal. I feel like they picked the right person to do that interview that couldn't speak thoroughly to what happened to her and the other people. I also find it interesting that the state of California gets a rebate on their restitution, which I noticed they're using the word reparations instead of what it is. It's a tort. You know what I'm saying? It's a restitution for damages. $25,000 is short of what is just for people that can never childbear again if they have already or never do it in the first place. I also find the racism very obvious with the interview of a 13-year-old female instead of her mother, who could speak to the racism and also speak to it because she can process it a little bit better. She may be more confused, but she's less confused than a 13-year-old. I learned from a friend of mine in Chicago that Lollapalooza mandated their performers be vaccinated in order to perform. And then she said that a certain individual high in politics prompted her daughter to go on a campaign to advocate for young people to be vaccinated with a quid pro quo of a show by my friend's daughter. And what ended up happening, they were in the space, a popular space downtown that would be otherwise hard to get, I guess, on their own. She said nobody was there, including this person that prompted them to do the campaign in the first place. I've heard about municipalities and sectors of municipalities requiring the vaccine, including the Regional Transit Authority in New Orleans for the drivers and whoever else, you know, at the depots, I'm supposing. So it's not going to be a matter of, you know, state mandate or federal mandate. They'll just punish a person through financially and then through public, you know, taunting and whatever the word is. I can't think of right now. I noticed with the St. Louis article, they have a problem with the schools. They should have a problem with the word St. Louis. I'm not saying that that's more important to them. It's just, let's understand we're in the system of racism. Who is St. Louis? Who is this city named after? You understand what I'm saying? Let alone this bishop. And I may have spoken on this before, but like even my alma mater, Warren Easton, was a person that did not want the desegregation of schools. And then later on in the 2000s, I can't remember when, they had non-white black kids singing to this not suspected racist, but, you know, admitted racist. They had them singing to his corpse at his graveyard, like he did something for them, you know, something to negate the system. There was more I wanted to say. Oh, the water. So this is what I'll end with. So water being contaminated or the lack of water is a problem that's addressed, obviously, as long as it doesn't affect non-white black people, because I swear, I think Flint still needs clean water. I haven't heard of anybody transporting water to them by tank. And I think I'm putting two and two together that as long as you live in a place that's considered an industry, somebody will come to your rescue, because you're probably not a black person. If you live in that place, you may be a so-called Mexican, but you're not going to be black. So we'll give you some water. Am I the only one that got that? And with that, I will end my turn. Hotep, and thank you, Gus. It's been a while. Good to hear your voice. And health and wellness to everyone else. Uja, Jeanette.
Much obliged, Irie. In Louisiana, and I do not recall images or hearing, because we have had a number of audio reports of Flint, Michigan. I do not recall any of the black victims of chemical and biological warfare in that area saying, oh joy, it's been rough, hair's been falling out, my children have been sick, it's been terrible, but man, we got a water tank now. They're putting it together on the front lawn. Woo! We are taking showers. I'm cooking. I'm taking a bubble bath. I don't remember that at all. It was bottles of water, jugs of water. And to my knowledge, people have been doing that for like years in some instances, not tanks. Negras. Black and brown, they say. Black and brown. Let's see. Much obliged to our caller in Georgia. Thank you for your patience.
Hi, everyone. I hope everyone's having the best evening they can have. Thank you for taking my call, and I'm glad the young lady before me could call in. Glad she was able to do that. Again, talking about water. Water is very important. I agree with her. You know, what's going on in Flint? They still don't talk about that. Also, I believe there was a few years ago a county in Alabama, Lowndes County, I believe. I think I looked up real recently to see what was going on. Nothing's going on. They can't even plant in their ground because the water, because the ground is bad. They can't even, you know, forget their bad water, bad sewer, just everything. The Child Protective Services, I don't have children, so I don't know about the need to eliminate Child Protective Services per se. But I do agree with the idea of helping families. It seems like that would be better for the children to keep the family intact. But, you know, it's not a white family. You know, the goal is, doesn't seem to keep that family, that type of, that family intact. And then about the, I guess it was an opinion piece, VGQ to the lady talking about swimming. And, you know, I agree with, you know, a lot of things she said, but the young lady, Simone Manuel, because I do kind of, I like the Olympics, I have to admit, I've liked the Olympics since I was little, always liked it. As proud of her, yay, you know, black, quote unquote, black girl magic, woo woo woo. She was not the first individual African American to win a gold medal. It was actually, and I remember seeing this race, a young man named Anthony Irvin. He's older now, he won again in 2016 after a long absence, but he won in 2000. In a similar race, I believe 50-meter freestyle. So, I mean, I know VGQ, but it didn't take that long to figure out how many black people have won swimming medals, not that many. You know, and of course, you know, I'm glad she's able to continue to work. And I don't want to disparage a black person or whatever, but I think it's important to strive for accuracy so that we can all be correct. I know it's a small thing. But, you know, I think it is important to strive for accuracy, like you encourage us to do in all areas. And thank you for encouraging us to continue to strive for accuracy. Thank you.
Just trying to follow logic. If we're in a system of white supremacy, racism worldwide, if the number one weapon is deception, just striving to be accurate should have a huge constructive impact. Enjoy the Olympics, man. Oh, and speaking of the Olympics, they did all that in that segment where they talked about this person got fired for making jokes about the Holocaust, and this person got fired because they said women talk too much, and all this. They totally left out. It was a black male who reported that, hey, these folks are practicing racism against me. Like, I was right there with the Olympics. I think he was a Senegalese musician. I'm going to get his name because I pulled the report up right. Oh, yeah, here we go. A Senegalese musician. They just had the opening ceremony and all that. And he said that he got totally taken out. And he said it was because he's black. I think I mentioned Latir Sy, Latyr Sy, S-Y is his last name. And he said he was not allowed to perform at the Tokyo Olympic opening ceremony because the organizers did not want a black face in the event. But enjoy the Olympics. Have fun. I've not spent a whole lot of time watching this year or even too many, even in recent memory. I think 2012 was the last time that I sat at Gabrielle Douglas. We were talking about that yesterday with retired firefighter and some of the other folks. I think that was the last one that I really sat down and watched and saw a lot of the different events and such. Anywho, other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Good evening.
Greetings, Rachel in New York.
I just wanted to go over some of the things that were mentioned today. As for the swimming and Black children, since 64% of Black children can't swim, I think it's important that parents do put their kids into swimming lessons, and they should learn how to swim. Not to make them Olympians, but just so they can prevent them from drowning. It seems like when it comes to anti-Semitism, that non-white people should be careful with that and put it in their code not to discuss that, because it seems like whenever it is discussed, they are treated poorly. They might lose their jobs, or people might call them insensitive. As for the German floods, it sounds like they were able to repair their homes and have a lot of people help them. That doesn't seem to happen to Black people when their homes are destroyed by extreme weather events. Another thing is that I heard, I think on another news report, that in Dubai they are seeding clouds with drones, which just means that they are actually causing clouds to produce rain. And then as for the sterilization, it sounds like anybody who goes into greater confinement has to be really careful, because anything can happen to them. So also Black children should be taught this early in their lives, that to avoid as much as possible being in greater confinement. Then in the Sundown Towns story, what Violet said kind of got to me when she was discussing, when she mentioned that she has to teach everyone. Like you said, Black people are not supposed to be teaching everybody about racism, white supremacy. Racists are supposed to be teaching us about racism, white supremacy, because they are the ones who perpetrate it. The last thing that I remember getting was a child abuse discussion. Like Mr. Fuller says, first time, last time when it comes to abuse between adults. I do agree that family should be supported rather than children being taken out of the family. And that's my report.
Much obliged. Mommying is tough work. I'll take much obliged to Gus T's attempted mother getting me into swim lessons. Said I went swimming this summer several times during the midst of our heat wave, our own extreme weather event right here in Seattle. In fact, they reported just recently, a few days ago, that the heat wave we had here that lasted, I think it was almost a week, where we had 3 days of 100 degree plus weather, that is the deadliest weather event in the history of Washington State, which I found, that is amazing. That is amazing. They've had floods here and all kinds of things, snowstorms and craziness. Like, wow. Anywho, that's why I said that Hurricane Katrina. Like, I've seen other events where there's some sort of natural disaster and white people get help. That's why also when Mr. Fuller talks about when racists, individuals classified as white, they'll try to shame Black people and say, oh, you're moochers and you're just getting all this and that. Everybody needs help at some point. It's nothing incorrect about getting help, especially if you've been harmed directly, justly, unjustly, whatever it is. Nothing wrong with getting help. Right there on display. Just frequently, as stated, Black people experience these type of things. The help just ain't there. Problem needs to be solved immediately. And young Violet, hopefully she, we're all still learning. Hopefully she will get it sooner than later that, yeah, these folks do not need a reminder from me about racism. They are living their best life and doing exactly what they want. growing up on the waterfront in California, practicing racism and really bragging about the fact that they don't have any other black people around to mess up their wonderful waterfront community. Classic sundown town, as they say. Number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. I'm trying to think. Have I seen black people swimming? They have an indoor pool in the Central District where the black people live. So they may have been swimming there. But in terms of the outdoor beaches and lakes that I've been frequenting this summer, not many black people I've seen in the water. I've seen them there, but they've been on the side and that type of thing. Not too many actually swimming. Usual suspects to blame for that as well. Other folks' comments that they want to make sure they share. Line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Retired firefighter in Florida. Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to everyone. I can indirectly just hear everybody just calling upon the retired firefighter to emphasize the importance of swimming for our children. You speak of, rightfully so, about proper eating habits, nutritious foods. Right along with healthy meal plans, or the thoughts of it with children, is swimming has to be somewhere in there. As people, we are at the earliest age is comfortable with water because we were inside of our mothers for anywhere to 6 to 9 months. It's submerged in water. So the earlier that you keep that person in that particular setting as far as not being getting afraid of water, it is essential. You're listening to someone who is actually assisted pulling dead black children out of ponds. As you know, I'm in South Florida. It is an area where there's a lot of water. A lot of people don't realize on how fast a child can disappear and be dead within seconds from water. It doesn't have to be a pond. It can be the pool right there in your house, and you're having a party of some sort. A lot of children are in that environment. You take your eye off that child is probably at the bottom of the pool. When children go missing, one of the first places law enforcement looks is the water, the areas of water in and around that particular residence where the child was last seen. And as I mentioned before, most of the drownings that I took part in were non-white black people. Most of them were black children, specifically black boys. Boys have a tendency to be a little bit more adventurous, that sort of thing, and they get themselves in trouble. And once you get in that situation with water, it is not rewarding. It's not helpful. And the child ends up, not surviving. Anyway, other than that, the next thing was I was sent one of the most disgusting if you want to call it videos, music video. I wouldn't call it music, though. Something that a five-year-old probably can put together, but nevertheless, it's mass-produced. I can't think of the name of the entertainer, but he has received, I believe it's Grammys that they get for music. Just think of all of the activities that goes on in greater confinement, including homosexuality activities. And that is what this video is about. I just can't think of the person's name, black male. Matter of fact, the majority, I only saw about maybe 30 seconds of it. I've only stand about 30 seconds of this video before I gave a report back to the person on it. But highly discussed it, and it is available. It is available for the very age of the children that I'm talking about who can suffer from drowning. It's available. It's at their fingertips. And this person is plauded as a child advocate, so to speak, from the video that he won this Grammy for. I just can't think of the guy's name. Slim, very slim, wear cowboy hats, that sort of thing, cowboy hat and cowboy boots. I just can't think of his name. If you said his name, I probably would recall it in my memory. But someone who practice what they call homosexuality. And that's my report. That's just was on my mind, in a sense. I'm almost thinking that, no, I'm not going to say that on this. Anyway, that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Retired firefighter choosing discretion. Sometimes that is the best choice. As for the swimming and being serious about that, and just getting your child at a young age to swim, so important for so many of the reasons that he outlined. And racists have done such a good job at keeping lots of constructive resources and things from us that just, make that at least one. Like, there's so many things that will be against your child. Like, hey, we're at least going to make sure that you're comfortable with water, safe around water. That's one thing that I've talk about learning. They have so many like boating classes and all that where they teach children and adults too, but for children where they'll teach them how to go out on the water and be safe and use all the different boats and all the rest of it and have your life jacket on so you can have fun and be safe. That word again, safe on the water. So absolutely get those children out there to a pool or whatever it is, something where they can safely learn how to swim. And just, man, for cooling, never know when it might be a heat wave when, hey, get to the pool.
Gus, just one more thing. Very, very important. Could I get 30 seconds? Very important.
I reckon.
Everybody needs to have in their vehicle. You can get them from an auto shop. It's a combination of a object that would cut your seatbelt from yourself, as well as it's sort of like a hammer where you can bust your window. You'll be surprised about the amount of water that you pass by driving to work, driving different places. You can end up inside. You could end up being inside one of those ponds. Your vehicle could go off course and get into one of those ponds and whatnot. You want to be able to get out of that car. A lot of cars, electrified windows up and down. And even if you have the old style, old school roll up and roll down, you're probably going to have some serious problems getting that window down. And most people have their windows up because they drive with the air conditioner on. Have that object in your car so you can get out of your car as it's sinking fast. That's all I'll say. Thank you.
spoken like a public servant, firefighter, safety. Love it. Having tools, life-saving equipment at the ready. Even I was thinking about that, like even having a fire extinguisher in your house. Important. Hopefully you never have to use it.
Oh, yeah.
Important. Even in fact, when he was saying about when the children go missing, if there's like a pond or a lake near the house, or if you have a pool, you know, have got a few nickels, or a hot tub, whatever it is, that the child might have fallen in there. That's the first place the police look. Man, if somebody didn't mention O.J. Simpson today, that's how he lost one of his children with his first wife, black female, drowned in the pool.
Sam Cook's child, and also the high jumper, one of the female high jumpers representing the United States. The father is her coach, famous football player. One of her siblings drowned in their home pool. I just can't think of her name. Randall Cunningham is the father.
Mm-hmm. Very common, sad tragedy. Just safety around water and get those children into a swim class at a young age. And then conversely, be very mindful about the viewing content. We've tried to emphasize that a lot over the years. They generally do not have constructive counter-racist programming available for viewing. Might be a few exceptions every now and then. I haven't seen Black in Mayberry, maybe, but most of it is not going to be constructive. So be very mindful. I don't have children, but be very mindful about what they are watching, what they are viewing. In fact, maybe even minimize not having a television in the house at all. One way to minimize, and then you can, you know, just monitor and regulate their computer use, Wi-Fi use, and all the rest. But I mean, that is toxic to the nth degree. The TV, screen time, all that. Other folks with a hand up, comments here that they want to make sure they get in.
Hi, Gus.
One of our other. Oh, that's Rachel RD. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, I just wanted to tell you who the entertainer was. It's Little Nas X.
Oh, much
obliged. I think that's the person.
Much obliged. Much obliged.
I'll be all right.
Yeah. Be very cognizant if you're a tempted parent about what content your children have access to. Can be dangerous. Let's see. Folks that we missed totally. People that we haven't heard from at all. There's one, Rob in California. Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Thanks for the program. Greetings to the callers and listeners on the line. Just adding to the commentary, I was going to state the guy's name, Little Nas X, but interestingly enough, I work with people that are high school age, and just the other day, they played a song. I guess it's a popular song out right now with Little Nas X and another artist. And I asked my coworkers, I said, isn't that the gay guy? And it was like, yeah, you know. And so when I asked about this Little Nas X guy, another coworker had asked, hey, did you see him, you know, making out with his one of his dancers on stage, which is the guy, right? And so I'm just, you know, listening. And so, you know, they making jokes about it, like, hey, man, you know, why was you watching that, you know, whatever. And they was like, man, you know, it's just trending so much, you know, whatever, whatever. And so I asked the question. I said, well, when he made out on stage with this guy, what was the reaction from the crowd? And from my observation, the crowd gave a bunch of cheers. And that's what I wanted to add. Thanks for listening.
Much obliged, Rob in California. Not surprised at all. Also to make sure I get in. Now, this is a twofer. Now, the two areas of people activity that we are not discussing or focused on for the compensatory call-in, entertainment and Area 8. Sometimes they get put together, like what we just got. Again, you can take it either way. This is going to be a lot of the focus. I mean, we could just have every program where we do this, because this is most of the content. It's going to be something anti-black. It's going to be promoting this sort of confusion, anti-sex. But we've done a lot of these already. I've never seen where television has been anything that's not this, going all the way back for Colored Girls. Remember that one? We've done a lot. So we could do that every Saturday. Or we could say that that's what entertainment is going to be. As long as the system of white supremacy exists, let's focus on other things. That's the route that I've taken, because we'll pile these up every. It'll be Lil Nas this week, and it'll be, you know, whenever Tyler Perry has the next movie where he's dressed up in a dress, and, you know, it'll just go on for a long time. I think some of this came up. They talked about it on a different compensatory call-in where it was, what was on Netflix this week? Oh, they're doing the Central Park 5, where somehow that also has now got anti-sex and all the rest of it. That's why. Compensatory call-in, no Area 8, no entertainment. Sex, entertainment. We should have far greater priorities given what's happening on the planet right now. Other folks who we missed totally, if you have a hand up, line should be open.
Hey, everyone. Let's just call it the 712. I just want to say the women and children swimming, because where I grew up at, which would be in the northern part of the country, in Iowa exactly, it was mandatory that you had to know how to swim. And I want to say you had to get it done by middle school. So that always confused me how, well, not confused me, but I just always thought about how I'm in Iowa and it's mandatory for me to know how to swim while I'm in school. Like, you can't graduate without it. I think they changed it now, but when I was going to school, and I was born in 74, when I was in elementary school, I remember that was big. You had to learn how to swim. And so, but children down south, where it seemed like it flowed, it's in between them to swim. And I just, man, I never understood it, but trying to understand more and more about white supremacy, what I came up with, and I could be wrong, maybe because it's more black children down south and they really don't want to bother with teaching, like, anything that might help you. That's all I come up with, really. But I could be wrong. I just wanted to comment on that with the children swimming, because that's very important. Thank you.
Much obliged for calling in to share, 712. I think your logic, I think, is accurate there in terms of so-called southern areas where they have a higher population of black people, so they don't want to share that sort of constructive information or have it be required in schools. I also think, or the long history of racism, white supremacy, I mean, it's not that long ago that, and they talked about some of that in the segment where they were pouring acid in pools if a black person was in it, or they're going to drain the entire pool because a black person was in it, or we're going to blow up the pool if a black person is in it, or we're going to close the pool down entirely as opposed to open it to black people. So with that, I mean, decades and decades of that sort of history across the U.S. I'm not surprised, particularly in areas where they have more black people, like you were saying, that they would not have a swim requirement. Also, to have that sort of requirement, you would have to have a well-funded school that has a pool to make this sort of requirement. I mean, where are we going to swim at? You know, where are you even going to test to verify that I can swim? So either the school has to be really well funded to have a pool. And I think a lot of southern schools, especially if they have a significant number of black people, like, that's not going to happen. Or there would have to be some other facility, a YMCA or whatever, that's reasonably close that you could access to do that. Now, I guess for a lot of towns that would be the case, but I mean, that might not necessarily be the case some places. So I could, and just racism, white supremacy in general. I mean, no, we're not trying to help non-white students, black students. I mean, we can't even get them clean. We're not even talking about swimming. We can't even get them water that hasn't been poisoned to the school. Flint, New Jersey, Lowndes. They used to call it Bloody Lowndes in Alabama. They used to get the nigger knocker and the Klan and everybody else, white terrorists, to beat them down. Now they just poison the water. Same effect. Context of white supremacy, compensatory call-in. I guess my final thought on that would be I would suspect they would have more of those type of requirements in areas where they have lower populations of black people. Like, I haven't checked here in Seattle, but I would suspect that they would probably have more school. Like, I think they do have high schools here where they have a pool at the high school. So they could have that sort of requirement. They might even have a whole gym swim class where you can learn all the different strokes and everything else, and diving class and all the rest of it. So that would be my general suspicion. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, if we missed you totally, make sure we get all the folks we missed totally first.
May I be heard?
Let's see. Our black female caller in South Carolina, land of Dylan Roof, Ben Tillman. Yes, ma'am.
Yes. Greetings to all the callers. Gus, good evening. Just to chime in on the swimming, I took up swimming maybe about 3 years ago, and I've been swimming consistently ever since, except for when COVID shut everything down. And the reason why is because as a child, I almost drowned. And I saw how swimming was such a – I've always known that swimming was like – a great exercise because you literally are moving most of the muscles in your body. Everything is moving. So I started with the water aerobics, and I got upset at seeing only the white people in the pool swimming laps. So I decided that I was going to take lessons, and I did. But I wanted to chime in only because we are talking about black children. And I wanted to give kudos to a facility in my area, and I'm in the area of the planet known as Columbia, South Carolina. We have a pool that it started out as a pool many years ago, I think maybe in the 40s or 50s, if I'm not mistaken, named after the great black physician named Charles Drew. And it was in a black neighborhood, and because whites wouldn't, of course, allow black people to swim with them. And Drew Pool became so well known that they had swimming teams, and black people had swimming teams, and they would compete against each other. And it was just has a strong, strong legacy here in Columbia. Well, they decided to expand the facility and make it a total wellness center because the area is becoming gentrified. And they have huge plans to continue to gentrify the area. So now you have a lot of white people swimming at a pool that was created because black people couldn't swim with them. They have a lot of other classes as well, but they do boast swim classes for young people, for children, and they have agreements with local elementary schools, and that's part of their development. Their gym class is part of their development, and they come in and they take swim lessons maybe every day of the week. I think they rotate with the school. I am not sure how they're doing it now with COVID. They're probably not doing it at all, but there was a concerted effort amongst the owners and the swimming coaches, the legacy of black swimming coaches at the center, to make sure that young children knew how to swim. So I just wanted to chime in on that, and thank you for listening. Try to mute my line.
I think she succeeded in muting her line. Spectacular. Black female caller in South Carolina. I'm not surprised. The so-called gentrification, white takeover, where they come in, and as she said, this whole facility, Drew Pool, this is compensation, really, for white supremacy racism. You don't want the niggers at your pool. Just at Dylan Storm Roof, Ben Tillman, Pitchfork Ben. We don't want the niggers at our pool. Okay, go over here, get our own pool, doing it happy, as she said, excelling, be great. Now, oh, no. Got to go over and gentrify the niggers. Let's come join their class. Now they come and Bogart the black pool and take over the pool over there. Like, wait a minute, you said you didn't want to swim with us. And they come take over this one and boot us out of this pool. Have to solve the entire problem in the system of white supremacy. And to do that sort of thing on a regular basis. But you can't come over here, blah, 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 fight and protest and all that, throw acid on us. Then you get your own pool. And they, oh, let's go swim with the niggers. And then boot the niggers out of their own pool. Whew. Replace white supremacy with justice. ASAP. Let's see. The number, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. She mentioned a caller in South Carolina. She said she, you know, started swimming and I guess had that accident where she almost drowned as a young person. Retired firefighter. He talks about so common. I remembered, I'm not even trained as like a lifeguard or anything like that. Nothing close. Just I can swim. That's it. But being out and swimming where a younger, it was a black female, a black child, young black girl. She's maybe, I'll say 10, maybe give or take a year. But she drifted. I guess I wasn't paying that much attention. Like retired firefighter said, you don't have to be out like at the ocean or something where it's 20 feet deep water or anything like that. Like it can be really small amount of water. This wasn't one of those super deep pools. I was walking on it. I wasn't even swimming. But she's only 10, so she's a lot shorter. And I think she got out around the 5 feet area where it was over her head. And you could see she was struggling. And like you said, does not take a whole lot of time. And I had to kind of help pull her back over to the area where she'd get her feet on the ground. It's just like, gee whiz, like that could have been crazy. Like, I'm not a lifeguard. I was not really thinking like retired firefighter. Like, whoa, pool can be a dangerous environment. Let's keep an eye on these children. Make sure everybody's safe. Not thinking that way. Like, woof. It is really important. Like, as he said, it does not take a whole lot of time. Water safety. If you have children, get them to a swim class pronto. Let's see. Other folks, if we missed you totally, if you have commentary to share, questions, thoughts, line should be open. Proceed.
Yeah, greetings, Gus. Greetings, callers and listeners. In regards to swimming, there's a couple of folks in my victim unit who are learning how to swim. My care mate, she's learning how to swim. She's 29, and her offspring is also learning how to swim. And I would suggest folks, if they're interested in learning how to swim, to maybe see if they have any community colleges that have swimming classes there. Maybe have a pool they could like take a class there. Because I know I took 2 years of swimming at a community college to refine my swimming skills. And also in regards to the news segments. I'm really confused as to what the white supremacists have planned for people who are sometimes called Mexicans, besides for their mistreatment. I'll do that line. Thanks for having a show.
Sorry about that, I think. So a little bit of background. I just want to make sure I heard you correctly. You said you are confused about what white supremacists have in store for so-called Mexicans. Is that what you were saying?
Yes.
Could you elaborate on the nature of your confusion?
The first aspect of my confusion comes from me not understanding what a Mexican is, besides the people they tell me who are Mexicans.
Okay. I certainly recommend or discourage the use of that term, because you can have someone who's classified as white who's so-called Mexican. You could have somebody who's non-white, so-called Mexican. Totally got that aspect. And that might be a part. We started with the segment about the census and the racial classifications. Mexican is not a racial classification. Neither is Latino or Latinx. I think that was the term they were using more frequently. But that's, you know, same thing. That's not a racial classification. So, I mean, hey, that might be a part of it right there, to just have you confused and trying to guess and figure out if you're talking about a white person. Are you talking about a non-white person? Are you talking about so-called black and brown people? That might be, you know, the whole goal of it, to just have you, us, confused and guessing about who are we talking about. And then, you know, makes sense. If you can't even make sense of the racial classification of the person, then might make it difficult to get any real understanding about what's taking place.
Hello, can I be heard?
Yes, I was just going to say quickly, also, Grant on the swim lessons for everyone in the class, spectacular. Never too late to learn, he said, going to the community college. That is an excellent suggestion or idea. If you have a community college in your area, they will have classes like that a lot of times where you can go. They'll have a pool, but you can go, as he said, refine your swimming techniques. Love it, and get the whole family in. Love it. It's a female caller. Yes, ma'am. Thank you for your patience.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I thought that segment about the Mexican, I guess, census was really interesting, because, I mean, I may have missed it, but I don't think they actually talked about what that person was going to do in terms of how they were going to actually help people classified as Mexican or non-white people in general. It was just that they had just hired someone who was non-white, but they didn't say anything about his political leanings or what his goals were. So I thought that was interesting.
Could be evidence of Mr. Fuller's term, racial showcasing, where, talk about confusion, he doesn't have a political agenda. We're not going to give him the chance, because most of the people are still going to be white. We'll do all of that deciding about the classifications and definitions and maybe even what he's allowed to do as the non-white member. But yeah, all of his politics and, you know, his itinerary, his objectives, what would he like to accomplish in his time in this position? Like, what we say, what we will allow him to accomplish. He can be out. I think they said they had the other black person who was in that position. I think they said he had it for like 9 months or something. Like, he can be out of here real quick, and we can go back to just having all white folks making out the census. Racial showcasing, say it correctly. Let's see. Much obliged, ma'am. Good point to you. Other folks who, folks we missed totally, anybody that we not heard from at all?
May I be heard?
Caller in Florida. Now, he last week, I believe, I don't know if he encouraged us, but he just said he had been paying attention to the use of the term unvaccinated. So I read the report. I'll make sure I get the segment in one more time. This was at Yahoo News, where they said they had a bunch of them. It wasn't even just unvaccinated. So this is the article title again. Patience has worn thin. Frustration mounts over vaccine holdouts. That might be another one to pay attention to, vaccine holdouts. They say 7 months after the first coronavirus shots were rolled out, vaccinated Americans, that caught my attention, including government, business, and health leaders, are growing frustrated that tens of millions of people are still refusing to get them, endangering themselves and their communities, and fueling the virus's spread. Alabama Governor Kay Ivey, a Republican, on Thursday lashed out amid a surge of cases in her state, telling a reporter, It's time to start blaming the unvaccinated folks. The NFL this week imposed new rules that put pressure on unvaccinated players, warning their teams could face fines or be forced to forfeit games if those players were linked to outbreaks. Now, even that, I didn't think about it before, but reading it a second time, like, unvaccinated folks need to start getting blame, and then they go immediately to the NFL. Lots of dark people in the NFL. Like, they could have picked any sort of business and talked about their vaccination policy. They could have picked a whole city. San Francisco said they're mandating vaccines for employees in the fall. They could have picked Pasadena, said the same thing. That's also in California. No. Let's go to the NFL. No count kneeling Colin Kaepernick. No vaccine. If you're the cause of an outbreak, you unvaccinated Negroes, we will get you. I don't know what your thoughts, but I did remember that from last week. And this article, I had a pen. I thought of you immediately, sir. Did anything in the report stick out to you or not really?
Yes, sir. I agree with you because I saw a report a few days ago on the news about the, I think that was the Alabama governor was saying unvaccinated folks. And I'm like, once again, they use that abstract language. But, and I'm also thinking of that audio segment where they were talking about, I think black and Hispanic or black and brown about the life expectancy. See, like they'll do a racial breakdown on that, but why won't they connect the racial classification to who are these unvaccinated, so-called unvaccinated Americans, or, you know, the terms that they use? And they seem to always, at least for the most part, they won't mention what white people are doing and how things are affecting white people. So I'm like, man, they keep using that term unvaccinated. And I think that's just more evidence to show that it does look like they want to try to connect it with black people. I guess I'll say in an indirect way, but I also came across an article where it's titled Statewide Task Force Faced with New Urgency to Vaccinate Black Floridians. And this, a little bit of it, it says the statewide coronavirus vaccination community education and engagement task force met Wednesday with an urgent plea to Floridians to get vaccinated as the state saw new cases nearly double this week. The task force is primarily focused on encouraging black Floridians to take the vaccine. The current vaccination rate among black Floridians is 23% compared to 43% of white Floridians. So, and then it also mentioned about using the media to get the message out to black millennials and black seniors alike or something like that. So I said, oh, there it goes again. So I'm definitely going to be keeping my focus and trying to continue to pay attention to that. And I just wanted to mention I think they mentioned DCF about the adoption cases and things like that. That has been a part of the job as well, where I have seen quite a bit of black people actually come into the office and the sadness that they're in, to where they're trying to figure out what's going to happen with their children. And they are correct. Those cases are very confidential. It's barely much that I even have access to with a login and everything. So those cases can definitely be intense. And the classification, I never thought about that as well, like how whites start with a W, like Mr. Fuller was saying. It is, they put it the first one, if it's lined out horizontally or vertically, it don't even matter. Like the first, what you set your eyes on is white. Definitely is white, not white European or Italian. It's just white. And then it goes to, I have seen that, Chamorro,
I've seen that on a death certificate in a file. That word is in there. I'm like, what in the world is that? So that is also correct. And the 13-year-old, it's just sad that that confusion is going on. But, of course, that's the system of white supremacy, and they do start out very early. Because I can tell by how the white children that come to the job that I work on, like the one that was saying, "Oh, I know I'm photogenic or beautiful," or whatever the child said, but she knew that it sounded like she knew that she was white and that the person saying that to her was black. And that's all I have to share. Thanks for allowing me to speak.
Much obliged, caller in Florida. And I mean, you can put that together with neutralizing workplace racism. He was talking about people are going to the courthouse, foster care cases and that, termination of parental rights. Like, that's something to take serious. Like, that's not, I come to the courthouse to harass other employees and make all kinds of nasty jokes and things like that. This would be, hey, I take my job serious. I'm here to serve the public. I don't know if they're coming here for something good, if it's to get a passport, they got a vacation, or if this is a court case, they're trying to get custody of a child back. Like, I want to serve Florida City. Nah. We come in and cut a fool area, put people's water on the floor and all the rest of it. Like, come on. Anywho, the foster care piece, like, man, you play around with sex, as Dr. Welzing said, the joke is on the offspring. Like, woof. There's nothing good about being in foster care, and then you got to go and wonder where you're going to be placed, and am I going to be moved? Are they molesting me? What other children did they have there? And on and on and on and on. White people know it is always best, unless it's immediate danger or something of that nature, having the child with the family. Having the child with the family, always best. If it's a poverty resource thing, get them the resources they need. Keep the family together. That is way better than the horror, especially for black children. Because I worked in foster care. They would say it is way difficult placing black children. Black babies cost less. You can insert that one there. We'll all pay attention, I reckon, to the whole vaccines mandates, how this evolves over the next... until the fall of this, I'm saying, but September, when they start, when they say the FDA may give like an official approval for some of these vaccines and what have you, and those mandates begin for certain cities, regions, where if you're going to work here, you got to be vaccinated. Whew. I could see this language becoming much more aggressive and common over the next couple of months. The really aggressive admonishing of unvaccinated folks, unquote. Whew. Be mindful, maybe even, you know, start thinking plans. If you're vaccinated, I guess it's maybe not too much to worry about. But if you're going to school or have children going to school this autumn, lots to process. Any other folks, comments, questions, thoughts they want to make sure they get in? We have about a little less than 15 minutes remaining in the program.
Yes, there is, along with swimming and water, there's a whole new science importance of being proficient with the water. It's my idea that the system of race and white supremacy will get neutralized. And it would be a time where non-white people would be reconnected with the earth itself as far as using it for the benefit of people as opposed to controlling people. And we're going to have to throughout young people get that interest with the water, whether it's the a lake, the ocean, in itself. There are so many things that that have not been discovered that can be useful to people. It could be an answer to some earthly problem that exists. And swimming is just one aspect of it, but you have to be proficient in that way. And besides that, the other activities that take place in the water, like scuba diving and such, there is a risk factor, but at least you will get CTE, you know, from it. I think that should be something that that we bring along with swimming also. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Amen. Amen. No brain damage with going to swim, and you can still burn a few calories. Use that as a means to get some cardiovascular work in. And I think that's one of those not putting too much stress on your joints. You can do that for a long time. So if you get a nice, long, robust life, not like the privileged black male rappers, you can be doing your swim exercise and stuff well into old age, safely into old age. So absolutely, swimming, recommend. Gus T, I'm not just talking on this one. Was out doing some swimming myself this summer. I hadn't been swimming in a long time. Even you don't forget it, even if you just, like they say with riding a bicycle, we'll come back with a little practice. Was great, loved it. Exercise, cool down, get in some swimming before the summer concludes. Any other folks commentary they want to make sure they get in?
Hello.
Yes, ma'am. Our caller in Georgia.
Hi. Not to bring up the Olympics again. Why I say that? I noticed, like, during the opening ceremony, you know, they have little children, and they had one child. I'm sure they're all Japanese children because it's Japan. I'm like, this child is black. I know black children when I see them. And then, of course, the person who lit the flame was Naomi Osaka, the tennis player, who is classified as black and Asian. So I just thought that was very political. But then I also just read an article while we were talking about, it said children of mixed race have it hard in Japan. And I'm reading the article. I'm like, no, it's black. Is black and Asian. That's what the problem is. Just call it what it is. It's not just mixed or whatever. So, you know, they, of course, at these events, they have showcasing. So, yeah, I do watch, but, you know, I tend to watch more critically, looking for things, you know, just to, you know, not just, oh, it's cute. You know, I'm trying to look more for, you know, I don't want to say correct because it's not about being correct, but, you know, the racial showcasing and things like that. And again, I think some girl, whatever, had called before, talked about osmosis when teaching, when it comes to educating your kids and the things they should know. Especially when it comes to something like swimming. I've taken swimming class in high school. I had to, the teacher just like, oh, go, good luck. I'm like, I don't know how to swim pool. So of course I got a D. And then I, as an adult, I did take a class at a community college, but same thing. Oh, I had already graduated. I was just kind of auditing because, like you said, I thought it was important to learn how to swim. But the teacher was like, oh, just, you know, just do your best. I'm like, I could die and drown. I don't think there's time for that. So if you're going to take a class, just like you would take any class, you know, research the instructor and everything. I did end up taking private classes. I didn't have enough money to take more classes, but I can float on my back and, you know, feel relatively safe, and I can float until someone gets me. I would need to do more, but, you know, resources. But thank you.
Floating on your back counts. Might save your life. Like, yeah, that, and that too, people going to take those classes and having some racist instructor who says, oh, just hop in the water. You got it. Go on, girl. Like, what?
No, the adult instructor was black.
Oh, okay.
In high school, that teacher was white. But no, the adult instructor was a black person. Now, our private instructor was a black person as well. She was excellent. I just didn't have the resources to keep up. She was excellent. Wonderful. recommend her, if you go to Memphis or wherever she is, Jennifer. She's probably not listening, but Jennifer was the best. Yes.
Right on for Jennifer. Right on for Jennifer. White or non-white. We've heard lots of folks where they talked about instructors for swimming and or other things, or just teaching in general, where they're not very responsive to black students, non-white students, par for the course in the system of white supremacy. Try to get someone who's going to be like Jennifer and really enthusiastic about what they're doing and there to help you and really vested in seeing you learn and do well and be safe if it's like a swimming, you know, type thing. Not just hop in, but yeah, take advantage if the resources are there, community college. If you have a YMCA in your area or a gym, what have you, they have like community centers here in Seattle, Washington State, really even beyond Seattle. They have community centers in a lot of places where they have pools, and sometimes they have the same type of thing where they'll have instructors and that type of thing, and sometimes those programs will be cheaper because they're at community centers. So check out, find the resources. Water safety for so many of the reasons that we have mentioned, even if it's just something to encourage you without fear to get out in nature and have a little bit more fun, maybe check out a beach or lake or pool or whatever it is. Whew. Get to the water. Any other folks, comments they want to get in before we wrap up?
Yes, I was just thinking as the lady was talking about the tennis star who represented Japan. I don't know if anybody knows that I think she had a choice between Japan, representing Japan, or Haiti. And she decided to represent Japan. And probably one reason why is because of getting that quote unquote honor of lighting the Olympic emblem, which is something that happens at every Olympic Games where someone gets chosen. I think most of y'all probably remember the time when Muhammad Ali was accepted for it years ago, back in the 90s, I think. But that's probably one of the reasons why she made that choice to represent Japan as opposed to Haiti. I could be wrong.
For sure, I could see the usual suspects having some influence there, too, even if it's just using words. Like, you know, Shay, don't you want some of these billion-dollar endorsement deals? You're young. You got a good 20, 30 years of your prime right in front of you. You don't want to mess around being associated with these, you know, island Negroes. Like, come on. Leave them alone. Let's just represent Japan. Yeah, we got the torch. It's going to be in our country. Like, let's, come on, do this correctly. Let's not, you know, goofy decisions that could haunt you for your career. Wink, wink. I'm not saying that had
probably
to happen.
Probably smart move for the Japanese.
Not saying it had to happen that way, but I mean, hey, even if you're thinking that way, I don't know what her thought process was, but I certainly put it this way, in a system of white supremacy, I don't think race soldiers would be happy to see her saying, yes, I want to represent for my black sisters and brothers in Haiti. They've had a tough time. The assassination of a president. I got your back, Haitians. I don't think so. That's not, no, we're not going to put that on the front of Sports Illustrated. I could be wrong.
Right, right, right.
Anyone else? Final comments?
Hello?
Yes, ma'am.
So I wanted to admit that I do not know how to swim, but in my code, I make sure that my offspring will learn how to swim. My older offspring can swim.
Love it.
Great.
Not passing on the parents' deficiencies to the offspring. Love it. And I mean, I haven't seen you, ma'am. I don't know you, but you don't exactly sound like a geriatric. You know, you don't sound like you're about to get your Social Security and have your retirement plans already. So, oh yeah, you could easily knock that out and get it done. You just haven't learned it yet. Some of us white people made it take a little bit longer for you to get to your swim lessons. But yeah, you could do that easily. Like, and enjoy. Then you could all go out and go swim together. I'm trying to go boating. Like, man, once you can swim, you can do other things. Let's go do some boating and all that. Sometimes they won't let you do other things if you can't do the swim thing first. So Yes. Just haven't done it yet. Any other folks, comments they need to get in? Everybody satisfied? All good for this weekend? We'll assume folks are satisfied. Again, we'll be here on Monday, normal broadcast time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We'll have Amy Schmidt. She is a white woman, the author of the book Right of Way, which again is about trying to talk about getting exercise, swimming and such, just walking, how disproportionately non-white people and particularly colored males end up being the traffic fatalities with regards to pedestrians, why that is and how that is a part of the design of white supremacy, racism. Where are the crosswalks? How many crosswalks are in your neighborhood? How many stop signs? How many street lights, stop lights are in your neighborhood? How wide are the streets? Do you have bike lanes? Do you have sidewalks? All of that goes into those numbers, and Seattle being a super, super safe city for pedestrians, not an accident. They don't have a whole lot of gusty renegades here. Anywho, that is Monday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Sobriety would be best. They mention that in the book. They blame, they say, if it's a Negro fatality for a pedestrian, say, oh, he was drinking St. Ides. He was drunk. He was out there. See, he had that can of malt liquor and he wasn't paying attention to the traffic. So for many, many reasons, sobriety would be best. In addition to being sober, if you're going out and about, not the time to confront strangers. Lots of gun sales, lots of stressed white people and non-white people. If it's someone being rowdy and hostile in public, I'd be thinking this person may be armed. And in fact, this person may have an entire entourage of folks who are ready to kill and die. If you did not leave your residence prepared to die and kill yourself, exit. Call the enforcement officers as you're leaving. All of that said, if you are driving, you're not on the cell phone, trying to do the small things that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, and we need all of our attention. Race soldiers, armed folks, lots of dangers. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. No name calling, no gossiping, small things that we can do to help solve this problem immediately, and teach your children how to swim, and or teach yourself with some help how to swim. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.